first to the party and last to leave. What do you say we party together? This is Sportsnet Today. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. We are with you until 3:30. Josh Goldberg, Show Ali, and then Leafs Nation pregame with Gord Selick, Nick Alberga ahead of the Leafs and Flames on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet on the television side as well. And we'll preview it with Pat Steinberg, Cheryl Pounder as well. But obviously a somber day in Leafs Nation show with the passing of Chief George Armstrong at the age of 90, the last Maple Leaf player to hoist the Stanley Cup back in 1967, scored the final goal of that series, and you know, obviously a legend, a Maple Leafs great on Legends Row. You know, so much, he meant so much to so many around the Maple Leafs, and we're going to talk to Gord Stelic about that coming up, who spent some time close to George Armstrong as a young intern back in the mid-late 70s, so looking forward to that with Gord. But you know, just a vestige of that past of the Maple Leafs lost, and you know, just a sad day for Leafs Nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you mentioned he is one of the guys on Legends Row, obviously very well deserved. I actually live, I think I've said this before on these programs, I live pretty close to the arena. So, you know, usually my walks or, you know, going to the grocery store and so on, it takes you by Legends Row basically every day. And it's cool to see George on that row, and he obviously was well deserved, an honor that, you know, he carried with him for his entire life. I mean, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame. His number is retired by the Leafs. Here's something I didn't know about George Armstrong until I was reading a little more about him today. People are sharing their feelings and so on with him on social media. He first signed with the Maple Leafs as a 16-year-old in 1946. He spent 75 years with the Maple Leafs organization, like in some capacity as a player, captain, longest-serving captain in Leafs history, coach, assistant general manager, scout, community ambassador, as we know, and of course an alumnus. That is absolutely tremendous. I can't even imagine spending 75 years with any one organization. I think that's absolutely a superhuman feat for him.
And also a trailblazer in the sense that he was one of the first of Indigenous descent, you know, to play professional hockey in the National Hockey League, and obviously inspired generations of Indigenous hockey players. And I'm sure if you asked Indigenous NHLers past and present if George Armstrong and George Armstrong's career with the Maple Leafs was something that they were told about or was a motivator, an inspiration of sorts for them growing up, I would have to imagine it was. And he bled blue and white, right? He played for 21 seasons, was a captain for a long time, and then left for a while, was with the Toronto Marlboros and then the Quebec Nordiques as a scout, and then came back to the Maple Leafs in 1988 and was the assistant general manager and a scout, and then coached for 47 games in the 88-89 season after Harold Ballard fired John Brophy because Ballard asked him to, and you know, George Armstrong was loyal to the Maple Leafs. He was loyal to Harold Ballard, and he did it. And then he was replaced by Doug Carpenter the following year and remained a scout. Basically, I think, you know, he obviously wasn't doing much the last few years, but was still considered a Maple Leaf scout, I think, pretty much until the day he died today. So he spent almost 50 years in some form or fashion affiliated with the Maple Leafs organization. And condolences to his family and the entire Maple Leafs organization. Obviously, a very sad day. Gord Stelic's going to join us coming up momentarily to give some of his thoughts and reflect on the great life and career of George Armstrong. But first, we want to hear look at the legacy and obituary of sorts produced by Sportsnet about the great Chief George Armstrong. So let's hear it.
I had always been a Leaf fan when I was a youngster, and I was very confident of my playing ability at that time, and I thought perhaps that the Maple Leafs would come along and offer me a contract.
That's center over the line to Armstrong. He's going in alone.
A lot of sweat goes into a hockey career in order for a person to win this. I suppose this is the aim of every young hockey player in Canada when he starts to play hockey, is to hope to play for a National Hockey League club and then to hope to get a Stanley Cup championship.
To be the Toronto Maple Leafs captain is both a privilege and a burden. George Armstrong embraced both and excelled at it. Conn Smythe once described him as the best captain, as a captain, the Leafs have ever had.
Well, this is the Stanley Cup. Last year when we won it, I carried off the ice and it slipped out of one of my hands and almost fell. But there was about 15 players that were underneath it and they were ready to catch it.
George Armstrong was born outside of Sudbury, Ontario, to both Irish and Indigenous parents. As a boy, he dreamed of one day playing in the NHL, but had no idea what his impact would be on the team just a few hours south. He was a standout in junior hockey, catching the eye of the Maple Leafs, who placed him on their protected list and quickly moved him up to their junior team, the Marlboros.
I spent 2 years with Toronto Marlboro Juniors. At the conclusion of the final year with Marlboro Juniors, I played for the Marlboro Seniors. We went on to play against Calgary in the Allan Cup Finals, and we're lucky enough to beat them.
Armstrong had two successful seasons with the Leafs' AHL farm team, the Pittsburgh Hornets, before joining the Maple Leafs for good in 1952. In Maple Leafs tradition at the time, sweater numbers of great players were passed down to the next generation, as Armstrong inherited his boyhood idol, Silap's number 10.
Is off now, Armstrong, should he score? Armstrong!
In 1957, he once again followed in App's footsteps and was named captain, an honor he would hold for a team record 12 seasons.
Well, I give a lot of credit to their captain, George Armstrong. He gives everything he's got out there, and I think that he's a great inspiration to his club. He's been a great captain of the Leafs, and I think every player on the club looks up to Armstrong because of the way he plays the game.
Armstrong led the Leafs to three straight championships in the early 60s, tying App's record for most cups as Leafs captain. But he will be best remembered most for his last cup against the fabled Canadiens in 1967.
It is now my very present duty and responsibility to present the Stanley Cup to the Maple Leaf Hockey Club.
As he skated to center ice to collect Lord Stanley's cup, Armstrong broke from tradition and had his son Brian by his side.
We had the conversation ourselves. We went out there and did the best we could, and we came through and we won. And certainly it wasn't easy because that hockey team never stopped until the last bell went.
He hung up his skates in 1971, taking his leadership behind the bench to coach his old team, the Marlboros, and winning two Memorial Cups. In 1978, he left the Leafs organization for the first time to become a scout for the Quebec Nordiques. But he would return to Toronto 9 years later as assistant general manager, scout, and briefly head coach. For all his accomplishments, Hockey Hall of Fame inductee, and seven-time All-Star, no Maple Leaf played more games in the regular season or playoffs and is the only captain to raise the cup four times. George Armstrong will be remembered as a leader both on and off the ice. The Toronto Maple Leafs raised his number 10 to the rafters while being honored on Legends Row to be immortalized for Leaf fans forever.
The first star, George Armstrong, Toronto Maple Leafs.
Across the Sportsnet Radio Network, we're with you until 3:30. Josh Goldberg and Show Ali taking you up to Leafs Nation pregame, which gets you set for a 4 o'clock puck drop from the Saddle Dome in Calgary. Flames and Maple Leafs, look forward to that. And as always, look forward to our conversations with Gord Stellick, one of the hosts of Leafs Nation pre and post game. And obviously, Gord, a very somber day for anyone connected to the Maple Leafs organization with the sad news of George Armstrong's passing at the age of 90. And you tweeted about an hour ago you know, working back in 1977 in the Leaf executive offices alongside George Armstrong and Johnny Bauer and King Clancy and other greats, what was that experience like for a young, bright-eyed kid like yourself being in such close proximity to legends like that? And what did, kind of perspective did you get on who George Armstrong was?
Hey, Josh. Hey, show. It's always a pleasure being on. It's a pleasure talking about George Armstrong. But you're right. It's a sad day. What a great life he had. And to the last part I put in that tweet, as I say, decades later, I cherish, you know, getting that opportunity. And so I'm telling you, the offices were very small and modest back then. Okay, so I don't know. Imagine you're sitting right now having a coffee or on a dining room table, and really, everyone's in your perimeter. There were not put like plush offices out there. And it was a very active, vocal, fun environment, you know, that time. And I mentioned the likes of King Clancy, Jimmy Gregory, who passed away last year, Johnny Bauer, a guy named Johnny McClellan, who just was a great, great guy, an assistant general manager, Roger Nielsen, and Jerry McNamara, and George. And it was, I loved soaking up and listening to their stories. Great senses of humor, including George, fabulous sense of humor. And what I thought about him was, you know, I can remember winning the Stanley Cup. That's a childhood memory of mine. And so he was the iconic Jean Béliveau type figure, the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs to the captain of the Montreal Canadiens. And Josh, he had a presence that way too. He was very tall and in good shape and really had a great presence. And then, you know, so you're a little bit in awe when you meet him, and right away, he's just very, very disarming. That he's as interested in what your life's about. Never cared about the show. Never talked himself up, and you just got to know him on that basis. Like how fortunate I am.
So, Gord, you were also the general manager, I think, at the same time that George Armstrong coached for the Leafs. Is that right?
Yeah, I actually we're going back a lot of decades, but in getting owner Harold Ballard's permission to make a coaching change on John Brophy, the only guy he would accept was George Armstrong. And George had coached, you know, 15 years early with the Toronto Marlies in the OHL, and he took it on an interim basis, which I appreciated. You know, at the end, it made for a difficult summer. Just, you know, we couldn't get that all in order, that situation. So he was the last coach when I was there, and I moved on to the New York Rangers. But I love the fact I was involved in bringing him back to the Leafs, because he was with the Quebec Nordiques for a lot of years. And, you know, he was there for 30 years. So that's great. So, you know, after that, he had basically another, you know, 30-year run as a scout right up until his passing. He'd still be in the press box, I guess, a couple of years ago. He'd make it to the odd game of what then was the Air Canada Centre.
So, Gord, I think that's really cool that you got to work with George and to see him, you know, meet him firsthand and to see his impact on the players. And I saw, again, we're talking about some of the tweets you sent out and people sharing their memories. And I think beyond, more than anything else, I think a common thread has been, and you mentioned it already, his wonderful sense of humor, right? Like, he is a really funny guy. He's kept things light. And there's a great piece up on sportsnet.ca written by Christina Rutherford. And she talked about how the late Red Kelly recalled back in 2013 that George always kept things light. How important was that to have around for someone like George Armstrong?
Well, it's huge. And modern days, you know, more and more, I think you look up what leadership and character means in a dressing room in any sport and really in any place of business. And you go back then that the owners and the general managers and that, they had all the power. And Punch Imlach was the GM and coach, and he won the 4 Stanley Cups, but it was tough for some of the players. Guys like Frank Mahovlich found, you know, playing under that system difficult, oppressive to a degree. You know, we're battling with him at times. And George was the guy in between. I mean, the captain really, really meant something back then. And he was the guy that kind of, as Red Kelly mentioned, that if there were any kind of issues, he was the guy that helped the player, that had the ear of Punch to a degree about things. Like he was the fixer. He was the fixer. And so if you talk to any Leaf that's still around from those teams, like, they won 4 Stanley Cups in the 1960s, and they'll always say there's, you know, Dave Keon, there's Frank Mahovlich, there's Tim Horton, there's so many Hall of Fame greats there. But the goaltending of Johnny Bauer and George Armstrong being captain, his leadership. Those were the two things. Those were the two most important things to win those four Stanley Cups over the 7 years.
Gord Selick is with us. What do you think it was about George Armstrong's personality and, I guess, his leadership style that made him the perfect fit for, like you said, a team with other personalities, other great players, other future Hall of Famers, and why was he the perfect, you know, captain leader for that particular group?
Probably a big part, you know, back then, Josh, was the fact that, you know, everything was high profile. Like, the papers really ruled, and, you know, radio did as well. Like, you know, sport, there was no social media. So, you know, you were at the mercy of whatever somebody wrote or somebody said. And the face was Punch Imlek, just like it was in a lot of professional sports teams. I mean, the face was the manager of the team or the coach or whatever it was. I mean, and so you had a lot of egos there. You had a lot of people in players and that, and you had a lot that wanted the, maybe the spotlight, what have you. And I think the fact that George didn't was huge, that he was just a guy that it wasn't about him. He didn't want any credit. He didn't want any glory individually that way, that he was able to do it quietly and, you know, sort of beneath the surface to be super effective.
So, Gord, one thing Josh and I were talking about in the previous segment was the fact that, of course, George Armstrong was one of the first players of Indigenous descent to play professional hockey. How much do you think that was important for other players going forward for him, you know, identity-wise, as he embraced that, considering, you know, he's the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs of all teams?
Yeah, you know, so that's an excellent question, because look at us 50 years later talking about it, and maybe put ourselves in his shoes back then. So he was half Indigenous, and, you know, and it was something he was very proud of, but he wouldn't say a lot of things. But I got to tell you, once we were out in Saskatchewan where the Memorial Cup was, and he had a line once. He just said, you got to be careful if you're native walking by the side of the road, because in a case, if a dog runs on the road, the car will swerve and hit you. Okay. And these were kind of his lighthearted observations, but obviously it resonated from his past, right? Obviously there you could see was something there, that obviously the things he kind of faced. So every now and then you'd get a snippet about that. But the other thing, Josh and show, was he came to the Toronto Maple Leaf organization, and back then they had a, you know, bunch of junior teams that they owned, and he thought he was coming down from Sudbury to play for the Toronto Marlies, their best team. And he got sent to Stratford, which was a team they also owned. And wouldn't you know, he led the OHA back then in scoring that year. And the next year, of course, they wanted him to come to the Marlies because that's their best team. And he was now, you know, and he said no. He said no. He said, you know, I didn't go there last year. Stratford treated me really well. And here's this teenage kid taking on Conn Smythe. Like, you know, you don't take on Conn Smythe. Well, whatever it was, he did go to the Marlies. But Conn Smythe respected what George Armstrong did, that later on he'll always say, the smartest move I made was making George Armstrong captain. And he did that in the 1950s, and you know, later on he won those four Stanley Cups. So it's an interesting question about, you're right, about the racism he would have faced, and also the incredible character he showed at a young age to do something that got accepted in a respectful way by a guy who didn't tolerate much from his players.
I guess one of the things that strikes me reading about him today and knowing a little bit about him and the reverence that teammates had and other personalities around the league had and coaches and ownership had as you know, George Armstrong for the captain that he was, it just shows, you know, the last few years, maybe the last decade or two in the NHL, the captain is still such an important part of any franchise. But that level of reverence where everyone looks to the captain as the beacon for the franchise seems to not really be as prominent as it was. And I just feel like captains like George Armstrong, we're not going to see them anymore.
Yeah, Josh, just look yesterday in the, you know, the Pierre-Luc Dubois, Patrick Laine situations, right? They both know they're going to be unrestricted free agents in a few years, so they have leverage. They both know, even as restricted free agents, they kind of have leverage, as it was proven, being able to force a trade. And George Armstrong captained a bunch of guys that had no leverage. They had no leverage, so they had nowhere to go. So if they didn't like where they were, unless management chose to trade them, whatever, you know, they were stuck. And he, you know, so you're right about that, that it's a, so as captain, he would try to make it a more tenable situation for all parts. I mean, he went to great efforts to do that. So yeah, nowadays, because players have so many rights, and they're friendly and all these other kind of things. You won't get the old-fashioned hockey captain like Béliveau or George Armstrong were.
Gord, we appreciate you taking some time for us last minute here to reflect on the life and legacy of George Armstrong. We'll be listening at 3:30 for Leafs Nation pregame for, I'm sure, more thoughts on Chief. Appreciate it again, sir, and we'll do this again soon.
Yeah, real pleasure talking about George, absolutely. So, yeah, I'll be on in a couple hours, and thanks very much, guys.
Gord Zelick, one of our favorites, one of the best. Host of Leafs Nation pre- and post-game, sharing some thoughts on George Armstrong, who passed away earlier today at the age of 90. And yeah, I like that point about where we are in, obviously, society as a whole, but in the National Hockey League. It's just, to me, it's different. Like, even a captain like Nick Lidstrom or Steve Yzerman, Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux in the last 15, 20 years, yeah, like Jonathan Toews, maybe to an extent, has been like that. Sidney Crosby, there are still maybe exceptions to the rule, but it's a lot different now. I'm not saying it's better or worse, but the leadership style and everyone looking to somebody like Gord mentioned, Jean Béliveau, or certainly George Armstrong, we're just not really going to see that anymore.
No, and you look at the Leafs of today, and I mean, Tavares is the captain now. I mean, considering how long George was the captain of the Leafs back in the 50s and 60s, 12 seasons. Like, just from a simple time standpoint, like, Tavares is not going to be the captain for another, what, like 10 years? Like, and I feel like that just the way, maybe the longevity of players' careers being a little shorter these days in terms of, you know, in terms of the demands on bodies and so on, and just the shelf life of players as a whole, I think you might never see that again, right? Like, you might literally never see, especially in modern sports, especially in hockey, a player going on 12 seasons starting now, right, for the rest of time. So yeah, I think it's really fascinating to talk about George's career, not just from a longevity standpoint of him being in the league, but simply being a captain of the Leafs.
Absolutely, and certainly a tough day for anyone, you know, past or present, who's a Maple Leafs fan, and anyone who I'm sure came across George Armstrong at any point, a tough day, but a long and great life and a great legacy left behind. George Armstrong, the last Maple Leaf to hoist the Stanley Cup, receive the Stanley Cup back in 1967, passed away earlier today at the age of 90. And again, best wishes to the entire Maple Leafs organization and George Armstrong's family. We'll hear that that obituary again later in the show, and I'm sure have some more thoughts. But coming up, the Leafs are in Calgary for a game today. Do we think that this is a matchup of the two top teams in the division, or does Montreal have something to say about that? Our pal Pat Steinberg will join us straight ahead. Josh and Show, Sportsnet today across the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This is Sportsnet Today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
When the night... Sportsnet Today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're with you until 3:30. Leafs Nation pregame follows with Nick Alberga and Gord Zelick. You set for Flames Maple Leafs at 4 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet, and look forward to that. And we will talk about the Leafs perspective with Cheryl Pounder at 3 o'clock. But right now, our pal Pat Steinberg joins us, host for the Calgary Flames Radio Network and the big show out at Sportsnet 960 The Fan in Calgary. And Pat, as always, good to talk to you, pal. And we spoke, like, I want to say maybe mid-December-ish, as things were really starting to take shape and it looked like we were going to get a Canadian division. And I wasn't sure if I was buying all the way that this thing would sustain for 56 games and it might get a little bit tired. I gotta say, we're only, you know, the Flames only played 3 games and the Leafs have played 6, but for at least one season, 56 games, I am wrong. This will be great. What do you make so far in the first couple weeks of the season of this division?
It's been good. Like, it's been pretty cool, and I think that the whole idea of not just back-to-back games, but entire series, like some teams playing teams 4 and 5 times in a row, I think that's a really cool wrinkle that we've never really seen before. The Flames haven't gone through that yet. They've done one with Winnipeg, and then they had two against Vancouver. They've got two against the Leafs coming up, but then they go to Winnipeg for three straight games to start next week, which will be the first time that we really see that baseball schedule truly in action. But I've liked it so far, guys. It's been. I mean, first of all, I think that we're probably in some ways grading on a sliding scale just because it's so awesome to have hockey back, and I think that for all of us, we would have taken anything. But, you know, if you take that aside and just look at it for what it is, I think it's been really interesting, too. And, you know, you had, for instance, you know, two really – I don't know if a lot of people would have seen those two games between the Oilers and the Maple Leafs going exactly the way they did with all that star power. I know that the Maple Leafs are a little shorthanded, but all that star power and all those huge names, and, you know, they turned into more – you know, real chess match like games where, you know, goals were hard to come by and it was a whole lot more closer to the vest. And I thought that was kind of an interesting wrinkle in a couple games between those two teams. So, yeah, I really liked it so far. And I think that, you know, for the first time seeing the Maple Leafs through town and knowing that, you know, you're not going to just see them twice in a season. Like, this is kind of cool for us out west. I mean, Montreal and Toronto are huge draws out here, and I know there's no fans in buildings, but still, to see Toronto nine times and back to back here is going to be really cool.
Yeah, I definitely think the a lot of people were saying, Pat, that the novelty perhaps would wear off, but so far it hasn't, not for me, and I look forward to a lot of these games in the North Division more than I think, you know, you're still watching hockey in the other division, certainly, but I think the North Division has lived up to the billing we've all been doing well before the season started. I want to dive into the Flames specifically with you, and I'm looking at some of the pairings and so on, and I think one of the more... On the D pairings, I should say, pardon me, and one of the more intriguing pairs certainly is that of anyone that includes Rasmus Anderson, because, you know, Mark Giordano on the back nine of his career, I think, to say the least, right? And Anderson is one of those players that has been moved around a little bit, and I feel like now with Giordano taking a teeny bit more of a backseat, you might see a little more excitement out of playing Rasmus Anderson on a night-to-night basis.
Well, and he's taken over the role as the quarterback on this team's number one power play, too. He's definitely one of the players that has emerged since the Flames drafted him in 2015. He's really, in the last few years, emerged as one of the no-doubt core players on this team. And the contract that he signed just over a year ago, that contract that kicks in this season, it looks like an absolute home run, and he's only played three games on it so far. So, yeah, this is a really important player on this team, and I think that when you take a look at the way things project going forward, this guy projects to be an everyday top pairing defenseman on the Flames for the next, you know, 5-10 years. And when you take a look at the potential fit on the other side, he's got that right shot, and so that's a real asset for the Flames. And then they've got another draft pick who was taken a couple years later in Yusuf Alamaki, who, you know, really hasn't played any NHL hockey since April 2019. He came into the playoff series against Colorado in April 2019, and since that time really hasn't played because he's been injured. And he hurt his knee in training in summer 2019, played some games in Finland after being able to come back from that knee injury. But he, on right now the third pairing on this team, he's projected to be the future number one left side D. So you've got these two, a 22 and a 23-year-old. You've got these two defensemen. One's already playing top 4 minutes and arguably playing top pairing minutes already. And one guy is only three games back into NHL hockey, but has looked good and projects to be kind of his partner down the road. I think for Flames fans, you're really starting to see what the future of this blue line is going to look like. And Anderson's a lot of fun to watch. Like, he's really, really gifted on the power play. He's a good skater. That's an area that maybe wasn't his biggest strength when he was drafted, but he's really turned into something that he's worked a lot on and now has turned into a strength. He's got good offensive instincts. He plays with a little bit of an edge. And defensively, he's a guy that is comfortable. You're comfortable putting him out there as the Flames coaching staff against anybody on the other side. And playing with Mark Giordano helps, because as much as Gio's 37 years old and is definitely on the back nine of the career, there's no doubt about it, he's still a guy that you can count on to play top pairing minutes as well. So when you've got those two guys paired together and they've played together a lot before, it really gives you a lot of confidence as the Flames to put them out in any situation and at any time of the game. But to your point, Show, where you're talking about taking a little bit of the pressure off of Giordano, he's not playing that number one power play time anymore. So now he's playing 45 or 30 seconds of a power play on the second unit. He's still getting number one penalty kill time, but just taking that off of his plate and transitioning Anderson in there, I think really helps to allow Giordano's curve to not be so steep on the way down. And I think having a guy like Anderson was really important, because not only is he good, but it also helps you maximize another really important player as he starts to move towards the age of 40.
So I don't want to get, you know, Toronto-centric with a comparison, but I do feel like there's a lot of parallels to the contract that Treliving gave out to Rasmus Anderson and the one that was given out by Lou Lamoriello back in 2016 to Morgan Rielly. Like, Anderson got 6 years, 27.3. Morgan Rielly got 6 years, 30 million. I think Morgan Rielly was a little bit more established perhaps at the time. He was playing on bad teams, so that probably helped. But that's turned into a great value for the Leafs for the entirety of the deal. And it certainly looks like Rasmus Anderson is heading on the trajectory where maybe he's a different player than Morgan Rielly, but the same way that kind of cap hit for a top pair defenseman maybe allowed the Leafs to do other stuff on their roster that they wouldn't have been able to do otherwise, maybe the Flames will be able to use that kind of low cap hit for a top pair defenseman to address other needs on their roster.
No question. And it's one of those contracts that, you know, they're not always the easiest to sign, because you got to have the right player willing to sign that deal, right? Because that's you're getting a good chunk of money up front. Like, don't get me wrong, I think all three of us would gladly take $27 or $30 million over 6 years, right? But, you know, as a player, you're looking at it and you're saying, okay, well, if I have two really good years and if I push for a bridge, you know, all of a sudden this cap hit of like 4.6, that could be like 6.2 or 5.3. But I think what is really good about these contracts is that, you know, so much of this game and the NHL has turned into a business. But I think what happens in these contracts is that it helps both sides. Like, so for Morgan in Toronto or Rasmus Anderson here, you're getting security, you're getting compensated. Like, it's especially for Anderson, maybe not quite the same for Rielly, but specifically for Anderson, like, he signed that contract before he had really established himself as an everyday top pairing defenseman. We all thought that he was capable of it. We all thought he was trending towards it, but you're still taking a little bit of a risk on the team side and hoping that your internal projections end up working out. But as the player, you're taking a little bit of risk on the back end that, okay, well, maybe I could have gotten more money had I taken a bridge right from the start. But because both sides are taking a little risk and because both sides are doing it in good faith, I think it works out for both. So you're absolutely right. From a team perspective, Josh, like, this could absolutely help the team going forward and help what they're trying to do with their cap situation, because it's going to get pretty tight here in the next couple of years. They got some contracts that look pretty good that are going to fall off, and they're going to have to make some decisions. So this is a really important contract for them going forward.
So then, Pat, as we look at the, you know, when we were talking about Rasmus Anderson earlier, you mentioned he is quarterbacking the power play. The other guys on that top power play unit that I'm sure the Leafs will see a lot of later today in this game today, I mean, I guess it's going to be Monahan, Gaudreau, Tkachuk, and Lindholm. Is that right?
That's right. And so they basically use Tkachuk as the net front guy. They work it as a kind of a true 1-3-1. So you've got Anderson who mans the point, and then they go Monahan, Gaudreau, and Lindholm, then play their offsides. Lindholm, when he's playing the wing, is usually a right winger, and Gaudreau is usually a left winger. So they swap them to get that ability to swing it around a little bit and to make their shots a little bit more dangerous off the flank, specifically Lindholm's shot off the flank, which is deadly. And then Monahan's kind of that man in the middle that you're trying to feed in the high slot or low slot areas. So it works really well, and it's been one of the things that has driven this team early in the season. Like, three games in, five of a possible six
points. You'll take that if you're Calgary. And a big reason why is the six power play goals they've scored. They scored one against Winnipeg in their opening season loss and five in the two games against Vancouver. And they look like the power play was one of the few real positives coming out of their playoffs. The return to play in the bubble, you know, they had some issues. Their 5-on-5 scoring wasn't great, especially with their big guns. Goaltending was fine, but the power play was something that really drove them. And they had a guy that they brought in specifically to quarterback the power play last year in Eric Gustafson, who left and signed in Philadelphia this past offseason. So credit to Anderson for being able to step in there pretty seamlessly. But those four forwards, they look like they've picked up right where they've left off. And I don't know. I mean, I think they were in a unique spot where I don't know how many other teams were able to have the almost exact same power play personnel and the exact same look on their power play. And so because there was not a whole lot of roster turnover with big name forwards on this team, those guys look like they're playing back in August, and it's been really impressive. I do think obviously penalty kills are going to catch up here as the early season goes along, but yeah, the power plays looked really good. And the other thing is their second unit, which, you know, usually it's not an even split. It's the number one unit plays like, you know, minute 15, minute 30, and then the second unit comes on and cleans up, but they have not been just throwaways. They've looked dangerous too. So right now, Flames, that's probably the area that they're most dangerous in right now is on their power play.
Pat Steinberg's with us as we get you set for Leafs and Flames at 4 Eastern, 2 Mountain Time, and should be a good one between what could be the two best teams in the division, but I'm sure Montreal has something to say about that. You know, we talked as the playoffs were getting started and afterwards about, you know, what kind of season we would expect from Johnny Gaudreau, who's 27. He's got another year after this one at $6.75 million, and is coming off of probably the worst season of his career last year, where he just, you know, he wasn't anywhere near the player who put up almost 100 points a couple of years ago. It's only been 3 games, but are we already seeing signs that he is going to recapture the form that led to him being almost 100-point player a couple of years ago?
Well, the last game we saw the Flames play, which was 6 days ago, I think he absolutely looked like that. I thought he was the most dangerous player on the ice, and he finished with a goal and an assist, got named the number one star in that game, and he absolutely looked like that guy. And I think there's some definite reason for optimism that what you're saying can absolutely come to pass. I'm skeptical he'll ever be a 99-point guy again. That was such a ridiculous season, and specifically such a ridiculous first half, not just for him, but the entire line of him, Sean Monahan, Elias Lindholm. Like, October, November, December, those guys could not miss. They were, for about 3 months, along with the Bergeron, Pasternak, Marchand line in Boston, like that was the best line in the NHL, and at least the most dangerous offensive line in the NHL. And then it dropped off after the All-Star break, and I think teams started to pay a little bit more attention and defend them a little bit differently. So I'm skeptical 99 ever happens again, but I do believe Gaudreau is a guy that should be flirting with point per game every single season right now. And I think the way that the Flames have restructured their forward groups opens the door for that to happen this year more than it would have had they not. So much of the offseason narrative here was about will the Flames trade Monahan? Will the Flames trade Gaudreau? Because they were really disappointing in the playoffs again. Well, the answer to that question was no, they didn't end up doing that. I mean, the fact that it was a really bizarre offseason and the economic situation is so uncertain, I just think it made it so that markets across the league were soft for trade. So they end up keeping those guys. But instead of just throwing them back in to the same situations that we've seen the last few years with Lindholm on their right and you guys are the number one line, they really rethought the way they structured their forwards. They moved Lindholm from the right side on that line and moved him to center ice, and essentially he's being used as this team's number one center now with Matthew Tkachuk on a forward duo. So you've moved Lindholm away from them. You've still got Michael Backlund, who is one of the better two-way players, better two-way centers in this division. And so you've got two lines that you're comfortable playing against the best players on the other side. Like, now the top Maple Leafs forwards the next two games are going to see a steady diet of Lindholm and Backlund, and they're not going to see a whole lot of Gaudreau and Monahan. Now, it's a little bit different because the Leafs are one of the deeper teams in the NHL, but what they've been able to do through three games is get Gaudreau away from top players on the other side and allow him to go up against opposing third and fourth line players at even strength. And I think that's the best thing for him because he's never going to be a guy that you count on for great two-way play, and that's okay. Like, think of Stanley Cup winners in recent years like Patrick Kane and Vladimir Tarasenko and Phil Kessel. Like, these guys are not what you call two-way Selke trophy front runners. They are offensive specialists, but they still help your team win in a huge way because of how they're able to generate offense. That's what Gaudreau is, and to, I think, a lesser extent Monahan is, and that's what we've seen a little bit more. They've been given some more offensively oriented time. They've taken them away, especially in home games, away from top players on the other side, and let them shine where they shine the best, where they excel, and that's offensively. So long answer to the question. I think Gaudreau is in a good spot to be able to bounce back offensively this year because they've changed the way they approach how they use him and his line mates.
Great stuff as always, pal. Appreciate the time. Have a good broadcast today. I'm sure we'll be able to check in a number of times throughout the season, see where things are at with the Flames. Appreciate it as always, and we'll do it again soon.
Awesome, boys. Enjoy the game today.
Pat Steinberg, host for Calgary Flames Radio, the big show out at Sportsnet 960, The Fan in Calgary. Always appreciate him taking a couple of minutes for us. Josh Goldberg, Show Ali here, Sportsnet today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. And you know, I was thinking about this as I was watching Montreal and Vancouver last night. I was one of many media fans alike who said, I looked at the rosters and was thinking, you know what, the Leafs are the top-tier team here in the North Division. And that might end up still coming to fruition. But Montreal, starting the first, basically, what, 2 weeks of the season, 9 days of the season, 10 days of the season, six road games, 4-0-2, they're deep, they're well-coached, they have good goaltending, they have an identity, they execute, they stick to that identity. To me right now, they're the team I feel like I know the most about. And it's fair to look at them as maybe the best team in the division, and certainly the Leafs are not going to be, I think, a runaway in the division that some might have, including myself, foreseen happening.
Yeah, I mean, you and I talked about our predictions for the North, and I think you and I, as well as a lot of people, just in general across Sportsnet and elsewhere, had the Leafs as number one. And I think still that maybe over the course of 56 games, as the season continues, attrition sets in, routine set in. I do think that the Leafs will end up as number one, but I agree with you in the sense that it won't be a runaway number one, right? And I think while Montreal probably will even out as well, everything will normalize, it has been stunning to watch them, right? I mean, like, Tyler Toffoli with 8 goals. I mean, his work over those 2 games against the Canucks out west that just looked was absolutely silly, right? I mean, it felt like something you had never seen before, right? I mean, we got to see, up front and up close and personal, pardon me, with Joey Anderson, certainly. Nick Suzuki has looked really good as well. Carey Price has looked good in spurts, although I don't know how, you know, ultimately he hasn't been the main reason for their success, but the Habs have been like just a flamethrower of a team in the North Division to start, but I still think ultimately the things will even out and they'll probably end up, you know, in that 3-4 spot in the division.
Man, I don't know. I'm really impressed with them right now. I feel like we have a pretty good understanding on Ottawa. You know, they've been scrappy and they, you know, they embarrassed the Leafs that game, but they've lost 3 in a row all to Winnipeg. They're going to be the 7th seed. Winnipeg will see what happens now that Dubois is there, and maybe that changes the conversation, but I still wonder about just their ability to put pucks in the net, especially with Laine gone, and their blue line is still not terrific, and Hellebuck has been up and down so far to start the year. I'm sure he'll find it, but you know, for me right now, it's Montreal, Toronto, and Calgary as the top 3 teams in the division. Vancouver's probably the 6th team. They look bad right now. They're not this bad, but they lost a lot of really good players and didn't particularly go about replacing them at all, and certainly not effectively. So I feel like they're going to be in for a pretty difficult year. And then Edmonton, you know, they split the back-to-back, the 2 games in Toronto with the Leafs, but the Leafs were shorthanded for some. And I just look at Edmonton's roster top to bottom, still not enough depth, the blue line's not good, and Koskinen is too inconsistent. So best case for me for them is probably fourth. Now it's just a question of who separates themselves for me between Montreal, Calgary, and Toronto.
Yeah, okay. I think that's fair, because I think my picks, if I recall correctly, before the season started, were Toronto, Edmonton, Vancouver, Montreal, with Montreal sneaking into that fourth spot. And, I mean, it looks like you said, it looks like they're a lot better than just sneaking in. But let's say Toronto and Montreal make it. And kind of parsing the differences between Calgary, Edmonton, and Vancouver right now, at the very least, because like you said, and like we talked about with Pat, Calgary's only played 3 games to Edmonton, yeah, 6, and Vancouver 7, right? Like, a lot more games so far for Edmonton and Vancouver. So I'll be interested to see how that sets in for Calgary as they begin to play more games, as the increased, simply increased playing time for all of their players, if that makes a huge difference, if they kind of like catch up a little bit, right? Because they're 2-0-1 right now heading into today's game with the Leafs, and the Leafs are 4-2-0. I don't know. I still think I'm not that worried about Toronto. I guess the thing I was the most worried about with the Leafs was the goaltending, and that has seemingly been solidified, but I don't know that you can really say the same for Edmonton and Vancouver, at the very least through their 6 and 7 games right now. Like, how much faith do you really have in, like, Mikko Koskinen right this second? Probably, like, zero, right?
None. Very little at most, but mostly none. And, I don't think it's Hellebuck's in there too, and that's why maybe the Jets deserve to be in the mix for the 4 seed, but you could say, at least right now, Freddie's been pretty good after a sloppy start, and certainly Carey Price has been really good as well. And Markstrom, it's been a small sample size. He already has a shutout in his first 3 games, and is also really good. So if all these teams can get that kind of consistent goaltending, I think that the 4 in the playoffs will be Toronto, Calgary, Montreal, and then Winnipeg. I'm out on Vancouver, I'm out on Ottawa, and Edmonton for all the reasons I mentioned. I'm not feeling great about them. But 4 o'clock puck drop, 3:30 pregame, Nick Alberga, Gord Selick will have it. We look forward to that. And we look forward to the AFC Championship game at 6:40, Bills and Chiefs. What is the one thing the Bills need to do to punch their ticket to the Super Bowl? We'll ask Dan Fate straight ahead. Sportsnet Today continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet Today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. We are with you until 3:30. Josh Goldberg and Sho Ali. We are 90 minutes or so away from the NFC Championship game at Lambeau Field. Rodgers, Brady, Packers, Bucks. Look forward to that. But come on, the main event, the main course, that's the appetizer, is 6:40. Kansas City Chiefs, Buffalo Bills. Can't believe it. AFC Championship game. Honestly, it's excited for a football game as I've been in quite some time. In addition to just the proximity to Western New York and how much we talk Bills on this radio station, should be an excellent, excellent football game. And to help us break it all down, Dan Fates joins us, sports anchor and reporter for Wham Sports in Rochester. And appreciate the time as always, man. And I guess, what's the buzz? Like, is it insane? Is it just like, is basically Western New York going to be completely shut down between the hours of 6 and, I don't know, 10 or 11 p.m., and then potentially longer if they win?
Yeah, it's a crazy dynamic thinking about the Bills getting here, because this was – it would have been so classic Bills to fall to the Colts, you know, or to lose to the Ravens, and it hasn't. And it's kind of – you know, I'm excited to still be talking about the Bills in mid-January, because the team hasn't done this in 27 years. There's a buzz that has just been building, I think, since Saturday night, or probably since Taron Johnson's pick 6. I don't know if anybody has stopped cheering since then. My sports director is out there in Kansas City. He said that the flight was already filled with Bills fans. They were chanting the shout song as they picked up their bags in Kansas City. Like, I was more afraid that the 17,000 fans were all going to be, you know, screaming Chiefs fans. But Chiefs fans are legit. They're not some Cowboys fans. Like, they're like Steelers and Bills fans. Like, they know their football. But there will not be – all 17,000 will not be Chiefs fans because of the excitement that the Bills are going. I know a couple people that have just bought plane tickets and flown to Kansas City, and are trying to scalp tickets. Like that is the level of faith that the Bills Mafia and the Cloud Nine that they're on right now.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be, like you said, Arrowhead Stadium is already one of the loudest stadiums in the league, like in terms of home field right. advantage for any team when you compare the Chiefs to other rabid fan bases. But the Bills Mafia travels extremely well. So I'm very excited to see what happens with Buffalo today. You know, one thing that we've kind of been talking on and off, I suppose, like I guess throughout this entire week, has been not just the concussion protocol for Patrick Mahomes, but that turf toe thing. Right now we're hearing reports that maybe in the offseason he might have to get surgery to get that repaired. If that's the case, like if he is even a little hobbled today, for a guy who moves the pocket and escapes and is pretty mobile, how yeah. important will that be for, you know, the Bills defense, the front four, the front seven, to keep him contained and inside the pocket so he doesn't get out there when things break down?
Yeah, you know, we look at the first game of the postseason where the Colts really had – or the Bills had to deal with the Colts and – you know, I joked around that with Philip Rivers, calling him statuesque is an insult to statues because that's how lack of mobility that he has. And then they went to the complete opposite and handled Lamar Jackson and pretty much shut him down and kept him in the pocket. And now it's a weird dynamic with Patrick Mahomes because you don't think about a guy that runs to run. He kind of runs to throw, but he also did lead the NFL in first down runs as a quarterback. So he does have this sneaky mobility. He did it against the Bills back in week six. But it's an interesting dynamic. I talked to Warren Sharp earlier this week, really smart NFL analyst, and you know, he's not a doctor, and I won't claim to be one either. But to see Patrick Mahomes out on the field, even just in some aspects this week, was a positive sign for Chiefs fans because they didn't inject or shoot up Patrick Mahomes' toe for practice. So the fact that he was still out there shows that he was probably at 60-70%, and then with an injection before the game, a pain-killing, a numbing thing that's going to deal with that. Warren Sharp's saying that he's probably going to be close to 100%, and I know the reports that came out today saying that that's going to be more of an issue than the concussion. I agree, but I don't think that he's going to be as limping around or as hobbling as he was against Cleveland. I think we're going to see a pretty close to 100% Patrick Mahomes later today.
Dan Fates is with us. I guess it's always important to get a pass rush and get the quarterback's kitchen, especially when you're somebody like Mahomes. But what do you think alterations, adjustment-wise, to try and force him out of the pocket quickly to see what he has, you know, throwing across his body, throwing on the mm-hmm. run? We know he's normally so great at that, but just to test yeah. and see what's there and if he's limited at all with that toe.
Well, I think Leslie Frazier has shown wrinkles in the game plan. You know, with the way that the Bills blitzed Lamar Jackson, it was, you know, Taron Johnson coming out of blitz, Levi Wallace coming out of blitz, Jordan Poyer, I think, will be blitzing today. It's not just from the front four. And the Bills' front four has been good this year. It hasn't been great. Jerry Hughes has been above average, which has been a pleasant surprise. But they really haven't been able to get a ton of pressure just sending four guys. So Leslie Frazier has been able to confuse quarterbacks, confuse offensive coordinators of where pressure is coming. And it's select times. It's not always on a third down. It's a second down to get a third and 16 after a sack. So I think they will pressure him. And I think they'll also make the running game beat them. Going back to week six game, you know, like Sean McDermott said, he picked his poison and was not going to let Patrick Mahomes beat him. And Mahomes didn't. He was okay in that game back in Orchard Park in week six in October. Only had 225 yards, two touchdowns to Travis Kelce. Like, I think that if you were to tell Sean McDermott and Bills fans that Patrick Mahomes is not going to throw for 250 yards and only have two touchdowns, I think the Bills will take that again. I think that this defense is a lot different than what it was, and I think the game plan will still be to make the running game beat them.
So, Dan, I want to ask you a little bit about some of these pass catchers for Buffalo. And, of course, we know all about Stephon Diggs and John mm-hmm. Brown, who looks much healthier now than he had yeah. in weeks, certainly. I mean, he was a huge part of that win over the Ravens, certainly. But yeah. Cole Beasley is, I think, where I want to focus on, because he went without a catch against the Ravens, obviously gutting through some kind of injury. But he's going into today's game, I think, without an injury designation. So if that's the case, I mean, I guess to a degree, you know, attrition sets in at this point of the year for all the teams left, right? So everyone right. is playing dinged up, obviously. I totally understand that. But at the same time, if he is going into this game without a designation, do you think we can probably say we'll see close to what we had gotten used to seeing out of Cole Beasley?
Yeah, and I think we're going to need to. I think that the Bills, and I think the Chiefs and Steve Spagnuolo's game plan is going to try and be to take away Stephon Diggs. Now, that is easier said than done because I think 16 other teams this year have tried to take away Stephon Diggs, and it just hasn't worked. But Josh needs that third down conversion specialist, and that's what Cole Beasley is. And we saw that against the Ravens, that the offense just wasn't able to sustain drives. Besides the first drive of the second half, which is where they got the touchdown to Stephon Diggs, besides that, you know, it was a struggle to get first downs. And I think that you're going to need Cole Beasley back. And, yeah, he does not have an injury designation heading into this game. He did pop up on the injury report on Wednesday. He wasn't on it – or on Thursday. He wasn't on it Wednesday. Popped up randomly. He was limited in practice, whether that was soreness in his knee. But he should be good to go this week along with Stephon Diggs. The question will be, you talk about Cole Beasley. It's also, what is Gabriel Davis's status? Look, I don't know if we're talking right now about the Bills if it wasn't for Gabe Davis's two catches at the end of the first half against the Colts game. That's not to say that other players couldn't have made that play, but Gabe Davis has been a nice piece of this offense. He's been like a dessert. Like, it's been a nice bonus to have him. I don't think it's a crucial loss if Davis can't go. He's been limited all week, only practiced once, and the Bills did elevate Kenny Stills from their practice squad to the active roster today. But Davis is a guy that knows this offense. He's been a part of it all season long, and with him not out there, it does take away some of that familiarity where Davis has been really good.
Dan Fates is with us from Wham Sports in Rochester as we get you set for the AFC Championship game between the Bills and the Chiefs. You know, the last meeting between these two ball clubs, it was weird. It was a Monday afternoon at Bills Stadium. It was raining. It was just a strange game. Tyreek Hill didn't do much. The Bills did a nice job against him, but Kelce got two touchdowns. But Matt Milano wasn't there. So how big is it to have Milano back and likely as somebody who will see a good amount of Travis Kelce in pass coverage?
Yeah, guys, he's massive. Milano, the Bills are undefeated in games where Matt Milano has played. You can start there. And then just the fact that I think we've talked about it a couple times when I've come on this show, just that I've never seen a better coverage linebacker in the NFL this season. I have seen him cover Darren Waller to some respect. I have seen him cover Cooper Kupp out of the slot in the Rams game. Like, this guy is a massive impact on this game. I think they'll rotate the coverage on Travis Kelce, but I think what Trey White said best this week was, this offense is so explosive. He's like, you're not going to shut them down for 60 minutes. But he said that he likes the resiliency and the maturity of this defense, that when they get a big play, they're not going to let it break them or break their spirits. And I thought that was the same mentality that they had to have last week against Lamar Jackson, that Lamar's going to get his plays. He's going to have these wow moments where you think you have him bottled up and it's a 7-yard game, but you can't get frustrated. And I think that's where this defense is so vastly different than when it was when it played the Chiefs back in week 6. Tremaine Edmonds was banged up that week as well. He wasn't playing extremely well. Like, this team, for all of the questions that we had about this defense starting on earlier in the year, they've really kind of answered a lot of them. And now they're playing with confidence. And that's a hell of a drug. That's what Micah Hyde told me last year, that confidence is a hell of a drug. And this team is listen to doubters. Last week they admitted that they watched TV before the Ravens game to hear experts and analysts on TV all say they didn't have a chance. This is a team that Sean McDermott talks about blocking out the noise and not listening to the other things. And here are the Bills coming out being like, we heard all of it and we loved it and it motivated us to play better. It's a really interesting dynamic. And Matt Milano was one of them. I tweeted out Matt Milano last week, said that they felt, quote, pretty comfortable they would be able to contain Lamar Jackson. And my mentions got blown up by Ravens fans saying, Lamar, he's disrespecting you. And then after the game, Matt Milano quoted my tweet with a Robert De Niro gif. Like, this team is on another level of confidence.
That's terrific. That's awesome. I hadn't seen the Robert De Niro thing. I'm gonna have to go look that up after we're done talking.
The Milano tweet was pretty good.
That's so good. You know, it's funny, Dan, because like you said, I think the three of us spoke in the middle of that, you know, less than inspiring run for the defense. And yeah, to see them turn it around has been nothing short of remarkable. Guys getting healthy, guys playing better, so on. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm really interested to see later today the matchup for Trey White, right? Because obviously we know how good Tre'Davious White is. He's one of the better corners in the entire NFL. But can we still expect to see him follow around Tyreek Hill? Because for as good as Trey White is, Tyreek Hill, in terms of sheer straight line speed, is something else, right? So I wonder if we might not, instead of just seeing Trey White alone on Tyreek Hill, I wonder if you might see like him in a safety or doubling him. Yeah. I mean, the Chiefs just have so many weapons. I wonder what you think that they might do for someone like Tyreek Hill.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think they rotate it. I don't think that they're going to show the same look over and over and over again. And for as good as Trey White is, you're right. He can't go in a foot race with Tyreek Hill time and time again and cover him one-on-one like he has with other wide receivers. Also, Tyreek Hill does a really good job. I thought Tony Romo broke it down really well in the game last week against Cleveland. He lines up in this slot and pretty much runs like a curved slant route to the far pylon. And the Browns just never made an adjustment at all. And if Tony Romo is analyzing the Chiefs' offense and can notice that, my money is that Sean McDermott and Leslie Frazier have seen it on film, and they're coming up with a plan as well. Like, you're not going to slow down or totally eliminate Tyreek Hill from this game, but you just can't let him have 3 20-yard completions. Like, that's where you got to, like, try and minimize this. It'll be interesting. I think that they will they'll double him a little bit. I don't know if I want Milano necessarily always dropping back with him, but it'll be a combination. You know, Taron Johnson has played well. They have Dane Jackson as well. I think it'll be a rotating, you know, set of cards that will try and confuse Andy Reid to the best that Sean McDermott can.
I'm curious what you expect from the run game today in terms of maybe the play calling, a number of run plays. Last week it was 16 carries for 32 yards. Singletary led the backfield, I guess, with 7. Allen had 7 carries as well. Do you think it'll be more of the same, or do you think we might see more of a concerted effort to mix in, you know, maybe some shotgun run snaps, draws, inside handoffs, stuff of that sort?
I think we're going to see a very similar game plan. Look, there were tough elements in Orchard Park, in that Ravens game, and people couldn't believe how much they were throwing the ball. I don't think Brian Daboll takes his foot off the pedal. I don't think he tries to start mitigating or controlling the pace of play with running game. I think he sticks to what's got him here. And guess what? It hasn't been talked about enough because the Bills' offense hasn't looked great the last 2 weeks. They'll admit that. But they've played good enough. They haven't turned the ball over. You know, they've been able to get first downs when they've needed to. The Colts were a really good defense. They had 3 first-team All-Pros on that side of the defense. They're a top-10 unit. The Ravens, a top-10 unit as well. And the Ravens were supposed to blitz Josh Allen to oblivion, and they didn't. And Brian Daboll and Josh Allen had to change on the fly. Tyrann Mathieu is great, guys, but the Chiefs can't hold a candle to the Ravens or the Colts defense. I think you're going to see a Bills offense get back on track and look like the 2020 regular season Bills that we've seen. There will be opportunities in the secondary. There'll be opportunities in the red zone. The Chiefs have one of the worst red zone defenses in the league. It will be paramount to score touchdowns when they get in there. And another interesting take is that Warren Sharp told me, both teams struggle covering tight ends. We saw last week David Njoku for Cleveland had his way against the Chiefs. The Chiefs not only struggle to cover tight ends, they struggle to cover them when they're lined up on the end. They actually do a pretty good job of covering them when they're lined up in the slot. So just a tidbit to look out for, guys. Watch for Dawson Knox to be lined up on the end a lot and start to be targeted a little bit more and to convert third downs, because that's another big weakness that Warren Sharp pointed out to me this week in the Chiefs.
All right, let's get you out of here on a prediction. Have you stayed consistent since last Sunday with who you think's winning this ball game, or has it been kind of a back and forth?
No, I've stayed pretty confident. Look, I think the Bills have the better offense. I think the Bills have a better defense. I actually think the Bills have a better kicker right now and better special teams. The only thing the Bills don't have is experience. The Chiefs are playing their 3rd AFC Championship game. Sometimes experience can be everything, guys. And then Micah Hyde adds, maybe ignorance is bliss. Maybe the Bills don't understand the magnitude. This young team doesn't understand the magnitude of playing this AFC Championship game. I think the Bills go to the Super Bowl. I think that they learned a lot from week 6. I think they play free. They're playing with house money. I got it 27-23. Bills go to the Super Bowl.
Wow, man, wild. I agree with pretty much everything you're saying. I'm taking the Chiefs, but I am not the least bit confident in that pick, and I feel like I'm going to end up being wrong, and I hope I'm wrong because it would be incredible if the Bills end up doing it. Should be good. Enjoy it, man. It's been a long time coming for Bills fans covering the team as well, so enjoy it, and we'll do this again soon, hopefully talking about a Super Bowl.
Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
Dan Fates from Wham Sports in Rochester covers the Bills for them, and really good stuff there. And we're going to give our picks for this one. I kind of teased it, but we'll really dive in to these two game picks in the 2 o'clock hour. About 2:45, we'll get to them. Lisa Ann is going to join us, host at SiriusXM Fantasy Sports Radio. Get her thoughts, some of her best bets for NFL Championship weekend coming up at 2. But straight ahead, more Jays rumors. Brad Hand, is he in the mix? Is there a possibility of a trade with the Cubs? Lots to get to. We'll get to it straight ahead. Josh and Joe, Sportsnet today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. Sportsnet today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. Josh Goldberg and Sho Ali. We're with you until 3:30. Leafs Nation pregame follows us. Leafs and Flames, 4 o'clock. Sounds like there is going to be a tribute of some sort to the late George Armstrong, who passed away earlier today at the age of 90. And Lisa Ann will join us at 2 o'clock to talk a little bit more about NFL Championship Weekend. Right now, Raptors, without Lowry, without Siakam, are down 37-36, 7 minutes to go in the second quarter. You can watch that ball game over on Sportsnet 1. And, you know, the Jays are going to introduce George Springer on Tuesday via Zoom. Look forward to that, no question about it. But there's still work to be done, and we got a couple of rumors today. Jameson Taillon is officially a member of the New York Yankees. Wouldn't have hated a Jays Taillon situation. I think if he's healthy, he's really, really good, but he's going to be pitching against the Jays a couple times a year with the Yankees. But there's some reports that maybe Brad Hand is likely to sign today, could come down to the Blue Jays and Mets. And then other reports that the Cubs and Jays have at least had conversations about a trade centered around Kyle Hendricks and Chris Bryant. And let's, I guess, start with, I think Hand is likelier, and I have made no secret that Brad Hand would make a lot of sense and would work. It's a little bit out of the comfort zone for what we know about this Blue Jays front office in terms of how they usually approach spending on the bullpen. But if George Springer, I talked to Caitlin yesterday about this, Caitlin McGrath, and if the George Springer signing did anything, it was, well, all the preconceived notions we might have about this front office should probably go out the window. So maybe they'll give 2 or 3 years to Brad Hand at 10 or 12 million a season. And it's definitely possible.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's for sure possible. And that's pretty much what he would have made thereabouts. It was $10 million, I think, was the player option that he got kind of cut over from Cleveland, I believe, right? So I think, I think that's definitely possible. I would love to see it. I think it would, his addition to this bullpen as presently constructed, considering that they just signed Yates and Chatwood as well, probably, I mean, it's already a pretty good bullpen, right? But it probably becomes the best bullpen, or at least one of the best bullpens in the AL East, I'd say.
Yankees is still damn good, right? If they, you still have that three-headed monster of Ottavino, Chapman, and Britton. That's still very, very good. Like, I understand Canley was hurt, but they lost him. It's not maybe quite as dominant as it was a couple years ago, but it's still really good. Rays is interesting. Still very, very good. I understand that they had some issues in the ALCS at times against Houston. Nick Anderson was not particularly good, but they're right there, I think, if they bring in Hand. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And I just think about the bullpen. You know, Ross, what's Ross Stripling's role this year? Is he going to be pitching in the bullpen? Is he going to make starts? I'm not totally sure what to expect from him. Baruchy, is he going to be able to back up, for the most part, what he did last year? There are still certainly some question marks, but a three-headed monster, potentially, and if you want to include Dolis to a lesser extent, of Dolis, Romano, Brad Hand, and Kirby Yates. Yeah, there are risks there with Yates, and what are you going to get from Romano coming off of that finger injury he had, and can him and Dolis back up what they did for the most part in a shortened season? But it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see the makings of a really good bullpen there if they do, in fact, end up inking Brad Hand.
Yeah, right. Because I mean, you talked about Dolis and Romano. You're probably going to see more of, I would imagine, in some capacity, maybe Kay. I imagine Ryan Barucki's probably going to be one of the first guys out of the bullpen going forward. Hatch, I think, looked very promising at times, yep, as well, as did TJ Zoik. So, like, I think there are a lot of guys who I'm certainly really intrigued by, and I just think that the deeper you get, and certainly Brad Hand would make this bullpen a lot deeper for sure. But as you continue down that road, yeah, I think, I mean, and I know what you said about the Yankees and Rays, but I honestly really do think the addition of Hand, especially as you're saying that, you know, you're basically subtracting Hand from one of the Yankees or Rays in the sense that he's not signing with them and you're adding him to the Blue Jays, I really do think it makes them maybe at worst the second best bullpen in this division. And I think that's really important in a team that, in a division, pardon me, that has all these dangerous hitters and hitter friendly parks. So, I mean, you can't have enough bullpen guys, I feel like.
I'm curious your thoughts on the possibility of Hendricks Bryant. Seems like a bit of a long shot, and I still don't know if I necessarily see that one coming, but it would be exciting.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, obviously, I think it's more likely, I think, that we see a deal just for Chris Bryant than it would be that you see a deal for both Bryant and Hendricks. I know both of those positions, starting pitching and third base, are both needs for the Blue Jays. I totally understand. And I also understand that the Cubs are certainly, after the Yu Darvish deal with the Padres, it feels like they're, you know, not on their way out, but they're trying to rebuild on the fly. So if that's the case, maybe it's a teensy bit more likely that the Cubs deal away both guys. But I mean, if I had to pick just one, give me Bryant. I want to see that infield solidified a little more. I know starting pitching requires some holes, but I'd rather, I guess, see them just get Bryant for a little bit of a cheaper acquisition,
yeah,
just quote-unquote money, and then go out and sign like a free agent like Paxton or someone else.
That's fair. The cost, I think, of just Chris Bryant, considering the year he's coming off of and the fact that he's making like 18-19 million,
yeah,
certainly not going to be as prohibitive as what it would cost for both of them. But yeah, if one, both, it would be great. We'll see what happens. Ooh. Nothing's out of the realm of possibility after you sign George Springer. It should be a very exciting rest of the offseason for the Blue Jays. Coming up, it's going to be a very exciting championship Sunday in the NFL. Who has more on the line between Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers? We'll ask Lisa Ann straight ahead. Josh Goldberg, Show Alley at Sportsnet today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
It all happens in real time. Don't be the last to know. Listen here first. Sportsnet today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. We are with you for another 90 minutes, Josh Goldberg, Show Alley. We'll give you our NFL picks, who we think is going to go to the Super Bowl in a couple weeks in Tampa Bay. So maybe some props as well. At about 2:45, we look forward to that. But right now, we look forward to our conversation with Lisa Ann, host of Lisa Ann Does Fantasy, Sirius XM Fantasy Sports Radio, and the Lisa Ann Experience. And appreciate you taking some time for us ahead of Championship Sunday in the NFL. And I'm curious, of the two games, you can't really go wrong here. It's, you know, as good as it gets matchup-wise. Which of these two games excites you more?
It's really tough to say, especially when we're looking at Kansas City and we're looking at Mahomes with turf toe. Like, I think we're all going to be on the edge of our seats with every throw that he makes to see if this really has any effect on his play. It definitely did after it initially happened in the game last week before he went out for the concussion. So I'm on, like, kind of pins and needles for that. But I think the most exciting game is going to be watching Tom Brady up against Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers has been playing some incredible football this year, and at the same time, the Tampa Bay Bucs have really come on strong these past five or six games.
Yeah, they've definitely gelled, Lisa. It really feels like, I guess the lack of preseason, even though we all kind of waved our hands at it because it went, you know, everyone kind of doesn't really care for the preseason, it seems to have, did have an effect on the early season struggles for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And like you said, they've really gelled. Who do you think has more pressure on them then? Is it Tom Brady to prove that he can win without Bill Belichick? Or is it Aaron Rodgers to actually get back to the Super Bowl for just the second time in his career?
It's really close with both, right? And I don't really think Brady is trying to prove that he's doing it without Bill Belichick. I think he's trying to prove that he can do it no matter what at his age. and that he can be a great leader. I mean, he has been a great leader. But then when you flip the script and you look at Aaron Rodgers, who changed so much of his game this year by taking quarantine seriously and going back and watching old tapes and listening to interviews with how he's changed his mindset, makes me see, like, I made my picks today at Bovada and I took the Packers and the Chiefs, and I'm getting a lot of resistance about Tampa Bay. But remember, there's a reason why no NFL team has ever played in their home stadium. It's just some of these weird kind of unknown unusuals, and that's what I play with this one. But Aaron Rodgers, the draft, how everyone talked about he couldn't go anywhere because they didn't get him any receivers. Look what he's done with even his tight end, Robert Tonyan, who nobody even thought about drafting in fantasy football leagues, and yet we're playing him this week in DFS.
Yeah, I am too. I like him to score a touchdown this week. Lisa Ann is with us. I guess, you know, one of the things with that's followed Rodgers around a lot is the fact that, well, you know, he hasn't been back to the Super Bowl in 10 years. He's only been once. He's 1-3 in the NFC Championship game. And it just it seems like quarterbacks always get dinged on their legacy for Super Bowls. For the longest time, Peyton Manning only had one. He got one in his last season to get to two. Drew Brees is going to retire with one. Dan Marino never won one. Aaron Rodgers has just one. Is it unfair that the quarterback really takes the brunt of the criticism when he's, you know, leading a good team and they just, for whatever reason, aren't able to win the Super Bowl when it's really hard to win a Super Bowl?
It's really hard to win a Super Bowl. And when we watched the Super Bowl last year, I actually got to go in Miami, which was incredible. You did not think the Kansas City Chiefs were going to be down by that spread at halftime. The Super Bowl is a different element. There's a nervousness. Like, we've seen it in some of these players just in this playoff run where, you know, you see a running back dropping balls and you're like, that's not normal. Ronald Jones dropping balls. Like, the pressure is on players who have never been there before. For Brady, he's been there. For Kansas City, Mahomes, they've been there. So I just think you can overthink it, right? It's a truly big stage. Everybody is watching your game. We're not watching Red Zone. We're not focused on eight other games at one time. We are all watching you, and there's a pressure with that. Like, do you get a good night's sleep the night before? I didn't sleep well last night because I've been hemming and hawing over this turf toe. So you have to think about all the variables with players and what they're going through. And, like, imagine just having a bad day, which we've seen. We've seen Lamar Jackson just have a bad day in a very important game last season, and that great run that he had all year last year ended up meaning nothing. They don't get to the Super Bowl.
So, Lisa, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned about Robert Tonyan and playing him in DFS, and I think that's great because whenever we talk about DFS, you know, we talk about, like, getting away sometimes from the really highly owned players. So I would imagine, like, tons of people playing DFS contests today are going to have Travis Kelce in a tight end over virtually everybody else. So savings-wise, I love the pick of Tonyan. Are there any other picks that, let's say, if you want to go away at wide receiver, if you want to ditch going to Devontae Adams, you don't want to play Tyreek Hill, you don't want to play Stephon Diggs, are there any wide receiver targets that really intrigue you today?
Okay, I'm going to tell you that I have Tonyan right now in my flex, and I still put Travis Kelce in my tight end spot and paid up. I'm going to tell you why. Just because the Bills' biggest weakness to me is their coverage of the tight end. We already know how hard it is to cover Travis Kelce, so there's that. When it comes to your saving some value, look, Scotty Miller, I think, is a good play today. Mecole Hardman, I think, is a good play today. Sammy Watkins is still looking questionable, but I really want Sammy Watkins to play because, you know, the kid has like four big games a season and he's only like 3,800 on DraftKings, and it would make my lineup perfect if he plays. If he doesn't play, I have to reevaluate, so it's going to mess up everything I've got going. But you got to look at those secondary players, and you have to look at, you know, we know that Devontae Adams is going to be covered. We know he can fight through that coverage, but on the other side, can Mike Evans fight through his coverage? If not, it's going to be Scotty Miller, who we thought would have a bigger season, but he's there when Brady needs him.
So I'm curious, in this limited slate where there's only the two games, you know, we talk about, you know, percentage of ownership and stuff like that. Is it just a case of, well, you cover your bases with the chalk of whoever it is this week? You know, Kelsey's probably going to be extremely chalk. And then you just go with a couple of lottery tickets and just hope that they're lower owned. And, you know, somebody like DeMarcus Robinson in Kansas City just has one of those out of nowhere games. And maybe that's the kind of thing that can propel you to a really good week.
Yeah, you kind of have to do that, right? Especially because it is such a short slate. It's always harder when there's so few games to choose from, right? So you have to be a little bit more willing to pivot and take that wild card. I think with wild card players, you have to really go with your gut, right? That's why I have this gut feeling with Watkins that I've had all week, and I just need him to play because I just have this feeling that this would be a moment for him. He makes these big moments when he needs to, and then he could just be such a dud at other times this season. So you've got to be creative. I mean, Cole Beasley is a decent play, right? You look at Cole Beasley, he's been banged up a bit, but he's very reliable. He will catch four targets. He will bring all four of those in, so I'll play Cole Beasley today as well.
Yeah, no injury designation for Beasley either, so I definitely like that one as well.
Finally.
Finally, right, yeah. Yeah. Last week, no catches, he really gutting out whatever it is he was going through with that knee thing. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing Beasley back on the field healthy later tonight. When it comes to that Tampa Bay-Green Bay game, and you look at the running back situation, right, because I guess you look back to last week and the Packers taking on the Rams, Cam Akers had a pretty good day. So I would expect the, one of Ronald Jones or Leonard Fournette to be given the ball quite a lot, if maybe it'll be a more even split. How do you deal with picking one of Leonard Fournette and Ronald Jones? I think Fournette is a little more expensive than Ronald Jones is on the daily fantasy side of things. Is that simply going to be what helps you make your decision in the end?
It is and it isn't. I mean, Ronald Jones played pretty well with that injury, but then we did see him take that run and come up lame. And so what concerns me is that Fournette's going to be able to break off more of the bigger runs. They're going to use them both. It's going to be a shared backfield. There's no doubt about it. But I have a much stronger lean towards Fournette being in the end zone and relying on him just because he's 100% healthy and Ronald Jones isn't. But you have to be, you know, that's the great thing about DFS. You can do four different lineups and you can see how all four different lineups shake out because it's been such a divide. And look, Brady talked about how much he trusted Ronald Jones. Then Ronald Jones has had quite a few drops this season, which hurts him long term. And, you know, I feel like they saved Leonard Fournette for this time of the season. You might as well get some use out of the kid.
Lisa Ann is with us as we get you set for Championship Sunday in the National Football League. You talked about Mahomes' turf toe, and that's obviously going to be something to watch. But as we're putting together our lineups, there's not really any way you can go super wrong with the quarterbacks. Like, we talk about how great the matchups are. It's four great quarterbacks. Like, how are you going about it? Will you have some Mahomes exposure because maybe he's lower owned because of the turf, or maybe just go Brady because he's the cheapest? And as we've seen, he still has those, you know, 350-yard, three touchdown games up his sleeve.
Yeah, I'm going to go Mahomes because he's going to be low owned because of the concern. I don't love Brady right now. Look, he threw for less than 200 yards last week, and the defense really won that game. And I believe if Tampa Bay does win this game, it's going to be relying on the defense. I mean, what they did last week with the Saints was just like, it was almost as mind-blowing as Conor McGregor last night. Let's just put it that way. Because at the beginning of the season, we saw the Bucs defense and the strength of the Bucs defense, and it kind of got watered down when Brady was putting up those 300-yard games. But he's not doing that. He hasn't done that in the past 3 weeks. So I would tend to stay away from Brady and lean more towards Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes, and Aaron Rodgers.
Okay, so then you mentioned Tom Brady and the under there. I Lisa like to sometimes dabble in prop bets and you know, sometimes less successfully as Josh knows. But you know, you mentioned the passing yards thing. One prop that I really find interesting today is Tom Brady under 285.5 passing yards. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a go. I mean, you got to go with the under on that. I do not see him throwing for over 250 yards today. I think it's going to be a very conservative game. I think they're going to lean on the run, and again, they're going to lean on their defense.
So when you're looking at props, you know, there's always so many. I always like, you know, the yardage ones or the catches or stuff like that. You know, where are you on when you're putting together a card? Like, what kind of props are you looking at most? Like, do you like the anytime touchdown? Do you like the first touchdown of the game? Because those usually have a pretty decent payout. What's kind of, I guess, especially today, but just in general, catches your eye when putting together a prop card?
I love them all because it gives you just one more layer to your anxiety while you watch the games, right? It just adds that. Sure, you're waiting on the total point. Sure, you're waiting on the win. But if you play that first touchdown prop and it happens for you, kind of settle in. If it doesn't happen for you, you get that angry gambler mind where you're like, let me go back on and look at, like, in-game betting right now. On the other side, I love rebounds, block props in NBA. I don't know why, but I feel they're so much easier to play and predict. And there's also a smaller pool, but there's just such a range of different props in the NBA as well, which makes it fun because I love to watch NBA. It's my first sport that I really fell in love with, and NFL would be my second.
So, Lisa, before we let you go, we'll get you out of here on this. With the two games today, have you do you have any predictions? Are you favoring one team over another? Are there anything you're particularly looking out for that we haven't mentioned yet? Let's get some predictions from you. I think Josh and I are both hoping the Bills win, for example, because here in Toronto we talk a lot of Bills. But at the same time, I'm curious as to what your picks are.
I'm sorry for you and Bill's Mafia. I feel you're amazing people. I love what you do for the plastic table business. There's so many great contributions that Bill's Mafia makes to society. Also donating to Lamar Jackson's charity of choice, Blessings in a Backpack, last week after he got hit was just amazing. But I am going to take the Chiefs. I just think the experience really gets in there. And look what Andy Reid did last week when we had that anything is possible moment. Andy Reid even blew Tony Romo's mind, who was calling the game. So I'm going to trust in the whole package of the Chiefs, and I'm taking the Chiefs and the points. And on the other side, the earlier game, I'm taking Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers and the points. Aaron Rodgers has just really put together a different level this season, and what he's done with players that dropping balls and still going to them, that just shows the tenacity. Lazard had that drop last week. He went over, he talked to him about it. He threw right back to him and he caught it. Like, that's big stuff here. That is big stuff. So I'm going for that because I have the trust in Green Bay and I have the trust in Kansas City.
Okay, before we let you go, quick plug. Next time we can hear you, what you got coming up as we get closer to the Super Bowl.
Tomorrow night, Lisa Ann Does Fantasy, 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. on SiriusXM Fantasy Sports Radio. That's Sirius 210 XM 87. I'm on again Thursday morning, 7 to 10 a.m. And then every Wednesday, there's a new release of my podcast, Lisa Ann Experience, for you all to enjoy however you listen to your podcast.
All right, great stuff. We'll keep an eye and an ear out for it. And hopefully we can chat with you again as we get closer to the Super Bowl. Really appreciate the time today.
I appreciate you reaching out. Enjoy the games today.
Lisa Ann, really good stuff there. Appreciate her taking some time for us. You heard where you can find her shows on SiriusXM Fantasy Sports Radio and her podcast as well. Really good stuff. Lisa Ann Does Fantasy and the Lisa Ann Experience. And yeah, I've been thinking about like what my card is going to look like today. I have my lineups in show. We'll get to our game picks a little bit later in the hour. And Allison Lucan's going to join us to talk about the Blue Jackets getting Patrick Laine and what went on there and when it became clear that Dubois was going to have to go out of Columbus. But those first touchdown scorers, I have hit the odd time in the past when I've done it, but it's those are so tough, right? It's honestly just as betting's always kind of a shot in the dark to some extent. You're trying to be informed and educated as you possibly can be, but that one is as luck, I feel like, as it gets.
Sure, yeah. I mean, can't you just see picking yourself like Aaron Jones, first touchdown scorer, and the Packers get down to the 1 yard line, and you're like counting your money already, and then Aaron Rodgers fakes to him and trots in at the 1 yard line or something like that, right? Like, how many times has that happened to all of us over the course of not just the playoffs, but the season and for everything and forever? I don't know. Yeah, the first touchdown scorers always seem to really get me. I tend to stay away from those. Like, you know me, I like the props in terms of I mentioned the Tom Brady under passing yards prop. I generally speaking like the under overs on passing yards, rushing yards, receiving yards, pass attempts, receptions, that kind of thing, right? But yeah, in a general sense, I tend to stay away because it just feels like it feels like more of a crapshoot. I mean, like you said, betting is always kind of a shot in the dark, like to use your words, but it feels like more of a shot in the dark than other things you can, I guess, like you can point to statistics and trends that way.
What would you say your overall record has been, at least in the playoffs? Have you rebounded a little bit? I know you had a couple of tough weeks or tough nights where there was some goose eggs, some bagels in there, but has it become a little bit of an easier time, or has it just been a disaster?
I think right now, that's a good question. I think, not counting any picks I make today. So for the first 3 weeks of the playoffs, I guess I'm, if I'm, I think it's like, I mean, they're like 7 for 14 or like 10 for 18 or something like that. Like, I've gotten, it's not under 50%. Let's put it that way.
It's not under 50%. Now, that's not bad. I feel like if you're 50% or better, you know, you're going to be pleased with that anytime you can get something like that. And I just, 55 or better, I feel like you're thrilled with something like that. Anything under 50%, like if it's 48%, maybe that's not terrible.
Yeah.
But yeah, you want to be 50, like in that 55 range. And then I feel like you're doing pretty good.
Yeah, I think, like, again, I don't make a ton of bets, right? Like, I'm not, like if you listen to the guys on Inside the Lines who were right before us, and, like, George, for example, makes, like, George has, like, hundreds of picks, for example, right? And I don't think I'd be able to keep up with that for my own, just, like, keeping track of that kind of thing. But, yeah, I think of the 15 to 20 picks I've made, yeah, it's hovering about 50%, because, like you said, a couple days, because I think it's kind of gone so far, like, on the Saturdays, because obviously both games today, only two games today, both on Sunday, but in the previous weeks of the playoffs, it was something like I would go over on the Saturday and then hit almost all of the ones on Sunday, so it would like make up for it basically. But yeah, I think that the thing for me, Josh, I have to really discipline myself, and I don't know anyone listening out there if you're like this as well, but if I go over on a Saturday, I have to really, really discipline myself to not like live bet things
of
at
course.
The end tail end of Saturday. So like, oh, I can get back in here. I can get a couple back. Oh man, I have to like put my phone down and not touch it until after the games are over.
Of course, that is right there the curse of betting in general. Gambling, if you go on tilt, you're chasing wins, ooh, you're chasing losses. You're generally speaking in trouble, right? If you have a strategy and a plan that you execute and you stay committed to, and you don't, I guess, really rock the boat too much and go too far outside your comfort zone, then you're going to be fine, relatively speaking. And, you know, you probably should never gamble. Like, I feel like that's probably just the easier, safer thing. But if you are smart and responsible about it, then yeah, that's as good as you're going to do. But yeah, once you start tilting a little bit, that's when things can get a little bit hairy.
I think I told you the funniest bet I think I've made of the entire playoffs so far was that Saints Bears game. And again, I had gone over that day and I couldn't resist. I put a live bet, I think, on the spread, and it was almost ruined at the very end when Trubisky, again, a meaningless touchdown, right? I think the Saints were up 23. They're up 21-3, I think. And I bet that I bet that it wouldn't be more than, I think, 31 combined points, I think it was. 31.5, I think it was. And at the very end, they hit Trubisky for the touchdown, but because it didn't matter, they didn't trot out the extra point. Like, you know that new rule they implemented, I think, this season, so they don't have to kick the extra point. And that was what, in the end, won me the bet, and I thought to myself, I'm never live betting again. Never, never again.
Yeah, that's sometimes I've had moments where I just say to myself, you know what, that went as ridiculously well as it ever could have, and I should just retire and never bet again because it will never get better. And you know, here I am, I still
here we
bets.
Are.
I haven't retired. I will make a couple today. You know, like between DFS and betting, I'm gonna watch the games regardless, and I'm gonna enjoy the games regardless, because you and I can agree we both love the NFL. But like Lisa said, it gives you that extra juice that just makes it so much more of an all-encompassing tense experience that it's just so great. And I didn't need ammo to enjoy the NFL more, but I found it and I enjoy it. So yeah, I'm gonna stick
with
it.
Are you still on the track of the NFL, specifically the NFL, would not be as enjoyable if you couldn't do fantasy or gamble? The product?
Yes. I still think that the game is enjoyable and I'm going to watch it, but particularly for casual fans, no doubt. Like, a lot of casual fans, I think, enjoy watching football, but as much as anything, they enjoy watching it to keep tabs on players that they have on their fantasy team, and obviously bets as well. And without it, you know, maybe some of that would disappear a little bit, and revenue and streaming and stuff like that might not be quite to the same level as it is with it. So it's been a huge boost to the NFL. It's been a huge boost to all sports, but particularly to the NFL. We gave we didn't really go into prop specifics that we like. We'll do that straight ahead. You had the Brady one under passing yards, and we'll give you our picks, who we think is going to the Super Bowl, coming up in about 20 minutes. But straight ahead, when did Pierre-Luc Dubois first really decide he was out on Columbus and out on playing in the city of Columbus and for the Jackets organization? And is Patrick Laine going to be able to drive his own line in Columbus? We'll ask Allison Lucan straight ahead. Josh Goldberg, Show Ali at Sportsnet today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Sportsnet today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. We are with you for about another hour. Leafs Nation pregame, Flames and Maple Leafs 3:30 with Nick Alberga, Gord Stellick, and then puck drop just after 4 from the Saddle Dome as the Leafs look for their 5th win of the season. We look forward to that. Allison Lucan will join us momentarily to get you set for what the Columbus Blue Jackets are going to look like with Patrick Laine in their lineup and no more Pierre-Luc Dubois. What a trade that was yesterday. Yeah, still kind of digesting it a little bit. Now Allison joins us. And good to talk to you. It's been a little while. Don't think we've spoken since Columbus dashed the Maple Leafs' hopes back in August. And certainly a lot has changed for both teams, but now a lot has really changed for the Jackets. And I guess I'm curious, like, when it became clear that Pierre-Luc Dubois was thinking that, you know what, Columbus was not going to be his future, because it seems like this came together really suddenly.
Yeah, well, first and foremost, thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, it was a crazy turn of events. This is a player who, at the start of last season, which, as we know, is over a year ago, was talking contract extension or new contract with the Blue Jackets. Those talks always sounded amicable. And then sometime this summer, it would seem, we're not sure if it was after the playoffs or when, his mind started to change. It's not something the player has chosen to share with the public. Why? He says he shared it with his coach and his team and obviously the front office, but it certainly was a jolt. I don't know that it was anything that people who weren't directly on the inside expected. And I would wager they were even surprised when it all started to come down the pike.
Yeah, no kidding. I think you kind of expected it at some point, but it really felt like it really came together really, really quickly. If you're going to look at, let's say, a quote-unquote winner and loser of this trade beyond just, you know, it's Columbus or Winnipeg, I feel like perhaps the biggest quote-unquote winner, again, using air quotes, is probably John Tortorella, right? Because, I mean, he gets to deal away somebody that, you know, he didn't really seem like he wanted to have on the team all that much anymore. And, I mean, we all know what Torts is like, but, you know, Laine has to come back from injury first, but at the same time, it probably gives him not only a bigger, shinier toy to play with on the top couple lines, but also someone he can probably mold into and dispel a critique that has followed someone like Laine around.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation, the Torts narrative, and we've talked about this. He comes by his reputation on to dispel that. But I don't know that this was a position of Torts wanting the player out. Former players, current players I've spoken with have said that with the way that Dubois was playing in this moment, from an accountability perspective, Tortorella had to do what he did in Dubois' final game in terms of benching the player. And we have seen John Tortorella always come with a spirit of honesty, of open conflict, and former players credit that for the most part when all things are said and done. This is also a coach who's in the final year of his contract, and there haven't been talks about an extension, so maybe he's ready to be done. I don't know that this is a reclamation project for him. I think he wanted Dubois to be the best he could be. I think they were going through a process. And I think, too, with Laine coming in, if Laine can be what Laine is supposed to be, this is a player that Torts is going to let run free. You know, he never tried to make Artemi Panarin the most defensive forward in the league. Yeah. a player who can contribute in a way that Columbus desperately needs is only going to be embraced by Tortorella, and I think that's something that gets lost, again, in the public narrative for reasons that I certainly understand.
Do you think then, Allison, that this trade coming together so quickly is probably another example of why it's good to have the I guess for lack of a better word, the synergy between the front office, like, you know, between Kekalainen and Torts himself, because you don't always see that with different franchises across sports, certainly not just in hockey. And I feel like to see that even with his last year of his deal there with Torts and Jarmo working together in that sense, that it bodes well, I think, even if the, you know, even if Laine doesn't necessarily stick around or Torts, you know, rides off into the sunset at some point, either way, I think it's good for Blue Jackets fans to see that.
100%. I think it's a great point by you. And again, it speaks to that spirit of honesty. You know, we're not obviously in the room this year, but in every previous season, to see the front office team working with Tortorella after a game, talking with him, being in total lockstep as far as having conversations was a norm for the Blue Jackets. So I agree. And Tortorella was nothing but effusive with his praise for what Jarmo Kekalainen did with the situation he was in. And I think, as you said, there are a lot of times organizations are at odds, not just between player and coach or player and front office, but front office and coach. And this is an organization that works very, very intentionally to not have that separation happen.
Allison Lucan is with us. I guess you could say any coach, any GM in any sport has a shelf life of sorts where, you know, after a certain while, maybe the message just doesn't get across. We saw that exact thing pretty much happen with Mike Babcock, who got fired last year. And is there an argument to be made that, you know, Torts has one, but maybe it just, it gets there sooner and the team maybe maxes out. He gets players to a certain point, but then maybe another coach and another voice needs to come in to get more or just something different out of the group and out of certain players?
Oh, 100%. I mean, and we could say that about any coach, I think. You know, I think what has allowed Tortorella to be successful for arguably a longer time than any coach, in Columbus, is that he's worked with a very young squad. He's worked with an organization that had to claw back into some level of respectability in the league. And I think that his leadership style has matched with that. I also, and I've talked about this quite a bit, the man learned from his experience in Vancouver. He knows. He is aware of maybe how he wants to let things go down in his final chapter. And I think he's done a lot of work on himself. But yes, I mean, every leadership position is going to require change. And again, we're not hearing talks about another extension. I wouldn't put it past him to want a break after this last final run he's had with Columbus.
So I'm curious what you think, you know, covering the Jackets and being in tune with the Jackets and the city of Columbus. Like, there seems to be this perception around NHL circles and fans who just, it seems like, well, players just don't want to be in Columbus long term for whatever reason. Like, we saw what happened with Panarin and Bobrovsky, and now Dubois, uncertainty, and now we'll see what happens with Laine if they can convince him to ink a long-term deal. What do you think it is about certain players maybe just not visualizing themselves with the Blue Jackets and living in the city of Columbus for the long haul?
Yeah, that's the question of the hour, if not the year right now. And, you know, I think that we need to move past the narrative that it's the city of NHL markets that look different. And I think Columbus is a great market for people who want to be there. And even if you don't want to be there, if you're playing, you're only there half of the season, and then you can go home to your cottage or wherever you'd like to be, as you should. But, you know, I think that that this is work that maybe the organization needs to do, is to say, are we looking at these situations? Are we taking lessons from them? Each of them is different. For example, Artemi Panarin was traded to Columbus and had always wanted to be a New York Ranger. That was understood. I think maybe not all scenarios have been that seamless. But I think it's a question for the organization to look at and to say, as we grow and evolve, as players grow and evolve, are we doing everything that we can to make sure that the talent that we want to have here also wants to stay here? If we can find the answer to that, we might solve world peace next.
Yeah, no kidding. When it comes to then, Allison, when it comes to Patrick Laine's I guess, spot on the various line combos. When he, whenever he does get healthy and he does slot back into the lineup, of course, where do you think he'll slot in? I mean, will it be at left wing? In, I guess on the top line it would be replacing Foligno, or would it be on the right wing and would that bump Cam Atkinson down? I guess, it seems like if you get someone like Laine, you want him to play with someone like Max Domi. But I wonder how you see that, I guess, you know, falling out, shuffling out there, and how that would move other guys to other lines.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I do definitely think that Domi is the center you want to play him with first, mainly for the passing ability that Domi has. It's interesting. It snuck by me when Domi joined the team. I didn't realize, if you look at some of the micro stats that are tracked, he's a player that offers quite a dangerous level of passing ability, which would obviously suit a player like Laine. I would probably suggest they talk with the player in terms of what side he wants to start on. Cam Atkinson has struggled, so I don't know that his spot on the right side of Domi is secure. It would certainly be open to Laine. And then, of course, the power play and getting him in there and getting him in the scoring position is going to be something to watch. But obviously a top six, and I think Domi is the center that he plays with first and foremost, given how Columbus looks down the middle right now.
What do you think Torts will hone in on, maybe one or two things specifically, to get Laine to be a more complete, more well-rounded player? I think he might be, it's a little bit overblown that he's just this complete sieve in his own end. He certainly needs to get better, but what do you think Torts will look at right away in a way of trying to get him up to speed so he can, you know, be a little bit more responsible and sound defensively?
Yeah, this is another money question for this organization. And I go back to the matchup with his center, Max Domi, and making sure that those players are being freed up. They're being paired on the back end with defensemen who can launch those players on the break, if not just on the rush, and really focusing on getting them offensive opportunities. I don't know that Torts is really going to focus on defensive responsibility off the gate. Again, I point to how he coached Artemi Panarin. That was a player he basically said, go create. And we accept that you're not necessarily going to play back as much as maybe everyone else is. I think that's okay, because this is a team that is so sound defensively, which does, to our earlier question, make the case that perhaps Foligno is on the other side of that line, creating a little bit of defensive responsibility, creating a little bit of bang and noise to give Domi and Laine space to create offensively, backing them up with some sound defense. I think the focus is going to be on making sure Laine is in position to score before he really asks him to focus defensively.
So we can't talk about this straight, Allison, without at least a little bit talking about Jack Roslovich, who is, obviously, it feels weird to say that he was like a throw-in, but I mean, the two main pieces were Dubois and Laine. What do you make of Roslovich's addition? He signed the deal now with the Jackets. He's a Columbus native. So I just wonder, do you see him appearing with the big club anytime soon? He's a center, so maybe he appears on that third or fourth line, perhaps. But I'm just curious as to what you make of his addition to the trade.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, this is going to be interesting to watch, because I agree. I think that this is solidifying some strength down the middle. That has been an area of weakness for Columbus for a while, and trading away Dubois does not help that at all. But it's going to be interesting to see where he slots in ultimately, because Columbus is not an organization that needs more bottom six guys. This is an organization that needs more top six guys. And Roslovich has wanted more opportunity. I think he probably starts in the middle, bottom six. Maybe he gets a look in that second line spot to see if he can handle it. But I don't know what this player is going to be long term. He wants to prove himself. I'm sure the organization wants him to prove himself. But other than solidifying down the center, I'm kind of waiting to see what he brings. We expect that he will probably draw in this week. He was already in Columbus quarantining as of, we believe, Friday. So that fits in the 48-hour window. But I would expect to see him in the lineup this week to start answering some of these questions.
So I'm curious, and Allison Lukens with us, I guess what you expect Pierre-Luc Dubois in Winnipeg to look like. He's certainly, you know, maybe not going to be tasked with quite as much playing, you know, with the likes of, and behind certainly Mark Scheifele and Paul Stastny's there, and you could talk about Adam Lowry as well. Do you think it's, as far as other destinations a really good fit for Dubois, where maybe he's not going to be asked to do quite as much, certainly not right away?
I think we may have lost her.
We lost Allison?
Yeah, I think so.
We'll try and we'll try and get her back. We'll try and get Allison Lucan back as we talk about what Dubois brings to the table. And, you know, the center groups now show in Canada, a lot of deep center position groups in this division now.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, you were just talking about the various combos for the Winnipeg Jets, and yeah, you add Pierre-Luc Dubois to that to a really strong group already center wise. Like you said, I mean, Stastny and Scheifele are no jokes. Obviously, I mean, I guess we were kind of talking about the North Division already when we were talking about, you know, Montreal's hot start and Winnipeg's hot start and so on. But I'll be really intrigued to see where Dubois slots in for them specifically, because, I mean, Blake Wheeler, Ehlers, Kyle Connor, I think, leads the league in goals right now. So I'll be really intrigued to see if Pierre-Luc Dubois does turn it back on, so to speak. I'm using air quotes, obviously. If he does turn it back on and play a little harder with the Winnipeg Jets, I wonder how much that'll affect the rest of that lineup, right? Like, we were kind of talking with Allison about how the fallout from a center position for the top six for the Columbus Blue Jackets will be, but they're already pretty strong, the Winnipeg Jets at center. So I wonder if who gets bumped down, or is Dubois then the third line center? I wonder.
Allison's back with us. Yeah, I'm curious your thoughts on how Dubois will fit with Winnipeg, and maybe if it'll be a benefit to him that he's not the undisputed number one center and he could get maybe a little less responsibility playing behind somebody like Mark Scheifele.
Yeah, I think that definitely this is a player who wants to have a little bit more freedom offensively. We know how locked down defensively the Blue Jackets had to be. I think he will relish that. I think he will relish the lack of the mental strain of the trade request. And I think he will really thrive in that spirit of competition, to not just be given a top spot. As much as people point to that incident with Tortorella on the bench during the Toronto series, we saw how it kind of lit a fire under him. And I think this is a player who will really grow and be challenged by competition to move up in the lineup, which only suits his game. I think this kid has a really good ceiling ahead of him.
And I'm curious, do you think the ceiling is, and before we let you go, what we saw certainly against the Maple Leafs when he was just an absolute terror at both ends of the ice and not just holding his own against the likes of Tavares and Marner and Matthews and Nylander, but taking it to them? Like, is that, if Winnipeg gets anywhere near that version for the next number of years, that will be a satisfactory outcome?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the wake-up call, not just to the league, but to the player, to really see this is what you look like at 100%. And now your challenge is to find 100% game in and game out. And as any young player has to, it's finding that consistency has been what he's had to work at. But that was a whole nother level. And if Winnipeg or wherever he ends up can get that, even 80% of the season, it's obviously a clear win and shows why he was such a highly valued asset on the trade market.
Going to be a fascinating situation to watch unfold for not just the next number of months, but year plus. We'll see what happens contract-wise for both of these players. This thing is far from being a closed book. There's going to be a lot of twists and turns. Very, very excited to see where it all goes. Appreciate the time, as always. Always great stuff catching up with you. Enjoy covering a new look Jacket Squad, and I'm sure we'll check in with you again soon.
Thanks so much, as always, for having me, guys. Great conversation.
Allison Lucan covers the Blue Jackets, one of our favorites. Always good stuff. As soon as that deal got made, we just said, you know what, let's get Allison on to talk about the Blue Jackets and what the trade means. And I might be in maybe a bit more of the minority here, Sho, but I, at least right now from my vantage point, I'm going clear win for Winnipeg. I love Dubois. I love the player. I love the versatility he brings at both ends of the ice, the center. Laine is a terrific goal scorer and will put up goals and points. I just still have questions, you know, 5-on-5, his ability to drive a line. Does he need somebody to set him up more than he can create for himself? Tremendous on the power play, great shot, a really good player. But like, if you told me who I think will have a more impactful next 5-7 years in the NHL, I'm going with Dubois.
That's a good question. You know, I'd probably say Line A. I'd probably say Line A is going to be more impactful. And I understand what you mean, because obviously centers tend to get a bit of a boost over wingers, just like as a fundamental look, I guess, right? But also with Line A, it's just that shot and that release is just wicked. It is just absolutely nasty. And it's just, I think what's dogged Line A beyond injury stuff, obviously, as he's dealing with right now, has been the desire level or the compete level, I guess, which is obviously not quantifiable. But I think now that he's going to a team in Columbus and he's going to be playing for a coach like Tortorella, who really does not allow for any BS. He wants you to play a very specific way. You know, maybe he'll have a little bit of impact on the defensive game. But as we spoke about with Allison, it's not like that really had a big impact for Artemi Panarin, for example, before he moved on. But at the same time, yeah, I think at this young age, because I think Line A is 22, if I'm not mistaken, at this young-ish age, I mean, Line A still has a lot of hockey left. And even if he doesn't stay with Columbus, I think he will have something to prove once he is healthy with Columbus. And, you know, whether he re-ups with them or re-signs with somebody else as a free agent, I think he is going to just be absolutely nasty going forward. I really do. I think Dubois is really good. Don't get me wrong. I'm not sorry to interrupt you, but I think Dubois is fantastic, but I think he is going to benefit more from playing with other really, really, really good players in Scheifele, in Kyle Connor, in Blake Wheeler, and Nikolai Ehlers versus Line A not having as many top-end players to play with.
Yeah, I think there's an argument to be made that could end up being the case, that just the lesser responsibility will allow him to focus in on the offense a little bit more and allow him to put up more points. I'm always going to go with the potential franchise center over the winger, and that's why those Matthews Line A conversations early on in their career were always wild to me, anyone was taking Line A over Matthews. There was a reason Matthews went first overall in the draft. The Leafs could have taken Patrick Line A first overall, but they knew Matthews was a better player, and B, you want the franchise foundational center, and to me, that's really what it comes down to, and that's not to take anything away from Patrick Line A. We'll see what happens. It's going to be a little while before Dubois makes his debut with the quarantine. Maybe it's a week, maybe it's two, but a little while nonetheless. Coming up, our NFL picks. We will pick each game. We'll do that straight ahead, and Cheryl Pounder will join us at 3 o'clock. Get you set for the Leafs and Flames. Josh and Joe at Sportsnet today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Sportsnet today across the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're with you until 3:30. Leafs Nation pregame follows with Alberga and Sella getting you set for just after 4 o'clock puck drop from the Saddle Dome. Flames and Maple Leafs on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet TV. Look forward to that. Cheryl Pounder will join us coming up, two-time Olympic gold medalist and the co-host of Her Mark podcast. We look forward to that. Get you set for the game. But we're 12 minutes away from kickoff of the NFC Championship game, and then we're just under 4 hours away from Bills and Chiefs, so it's pick time. I've been on Kansas City, Green Bay, I said this yesterday, for weeks before the playoffs. As much as I want to pick the Bills, and part of me is almost expecting the Bills to win because it just sort of feels like fate at this point, I'm not going to go against it. I've been with it. It wasn't exactly going out on a limb because they were the two best teams for the most part in football all year, and they were both the one seeds, but I'm not going away from it. They're both at home. I think both games are going to be really good, but I'm going with Kansas City and Green Bay.
All right, yeah, I like it. I mean, like you said, the two top teams, hard to pick against them, obviously. Two teams that are so multifaceted and have different approaches to their offenses. Defenses that are, you know, okay at best, I feel like, but still have some stars on those teams. So yeah, I don't mind those picks, but you know, it's funny. When I did the video for Sportsnet and Andy McNamara and I made our picks, I went Bills Bucks as the Super Bowl pick well before, just because I wanted to see Brady play the Bills one more time. Sure. And it's possible still. It's still the possibility that is still alive. So I can't go against that now, Josh. I'm going to stick with the Bills, and I'm going to stick with the Bucks with a major upset of Aaron Rodgers at Lambeau Field.
Imagine if I've been thinking of this, and I think spoke a little bit about it, and just imagine if the Bills get to play for the Super Bowl for the first time in approaching 30 years since they lost the fourth of four straight, you know, back in the early 90s. And it would be against Tom Brady. And you finally thought you were rid of him and the Patriots. And you've taken the AFC East back and a chance to win the franchise's first Super Bowl and the first championship, I believe. Yes, in the city of Buffalo. And you would have to go up against against Tom Brady to do it. So
yeah, that, he's like the boogeyman.
Did the Sabres win a cup? I can't remember if the Sabres won a cup.
but even if, like, either way, right? Like, no matter what the success of the Sabres is or has been or will be, if the Bills win a Super Bowl in Buffalo, they will be immortal for the rest of time.
Yeah.
Even beyond Jim Kelly, even, right? And Thurman Thomas and all these other guys. Like, they will. No, I'm not saying they'll be forgotten, but if the Bills go on and win the Super Bowl, Josh Allen and Stephon Diggs will be the names up on the ring of honor at a New Era Stadium in Orchard Park whenever they build a new stadium. Like, they will be living legends literally for the rest of time in the city of Buffalo. And I think if they were to beat Tom Brady as the, you know, the Baba Yaga of Buffalo Bills sports history, I think that would just be the most monumental achievement. I think, like, it's a movie. It's like a movie narrative, basically.
I should have stuck with my gut. I figured, and I thought I was right. Yeah, the Buffalo Sabres have not won a Stanley Cup. The city of Buffalo has never seen a championship. They have no parades. It's probably the most cursed and most heartbreak city, sports city in North America. You know, Cleveland is up there, but they got the championship
Detroit
with LeBron back in 2016. Detroit with the Red Wings and stuff, right? The Red Wings won all those cups.
Okay.
Pistons won an NBA title and they won a couple in the Isaiah Thomas. I just feel like, for me, it's right now it's Toronto and Buffalo, and they're so close together. But I guess the Jays got a World Series within the last three decades, so it's Buffalo. And yeah, if they could do it and beat Brady, oh man, imagine what that will be like.
Oh,
so we're
goodness.
On opposite ends of the spectrum. I've got Kansas City, Green Bay. You've got Buffalo, Tampa. Kickoff in 10. Can't wait for it. Can't wait for Flames, Maple Leafs at 4 o'clock, 3:30 pregame show. We'll talk to Cheryl Pander straight ahead. Are we less worried about Freddie Anderson after that great start? We'll check in with Cheryl coming up. Josh and Show at Sportsnet today across the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Welcome to the Front Lines. This is Sportsnet Today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Today across the Sportsnet Radio Network, getting you set for Maple Leafs and Flames. Josh Goldberg, Show Adley. Leafs Nation pregame gets going 3:30 with Nick Alberga and Gord Stellick. They'll have Leafs Nation postgame after the final horn. Joe Bo and Jim Ralph have the call from Toronto, but the game's in Calgary just after 4 on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. You can watch it on Sportsnet as well. And really pleased now to be joined by Cheryl Pander, two-time Olympic gold medalist and co-host of the Her Mark podcast. And Cheryl, appreciate the time on a Sunday afternoon. Hope all is well. And I gotta say, I have been a little bit uneasy with Freddie Anderson's play to start the season, but he was excellent on Friday night against Edmonton. And I think that's the kind of start that will ease a lot of people, myself included, I guess, uneasiness. How much do you think a start like that can really propel him to becoming the goalie that a lot of people came to know and love for a lot of his time as a Maple Leaf?
Well, let's face it. I mean, goaltending is so important, as we all know. And yeah, I mean, Freddie wasn't so steady those first two games, if you will. And but as noted in his save percentage over the last three, I think he's .938 or something around that nature. He's just looked so much more confident, not really swimming around the net, tracking the puck so much better. And of course, that breeds confidence from the net all the way out. So certainly, I think Leaf Nation and everyone around can certainly take a breath because, hey, he's one of the best.
So, Cheryl, one thing that Josh and I have talked about kind of in the weeks leading up to the 56-game season was, I guess, how many games Freddie would start in a condensed season, because you think to yourself, okay, well, the NHL is going more towards a split of goaltending duties anyways, but if the Leafs do make the playoffs in the North Division, you want your starting goaltender to be as fresh as possible. So considering we've talked about Freddie and he looks a little better and he's settled down a little bit, what do you think the overall percentage split of Freddie's games versus, let's say, Jack Campbell's games will be for the rest of the season?
Well, I think, you know, it's a real tough call, and I've been listening like everyone else has been about this particular situation, whether it's with the players and especially the goaltending. And you know, what is that number? And whether it's a day-to-day call, because depending on whether they've been beaten up, what their schedule is looking like. I mean, look at Calgary right now. They're on their sixth day since their last game. But for someone like Freddie Anderson, you know, we were thinking, you know, somewhere if you got in around 10 games, Jack Campbell got in, you might be looking at somewhere around that. But I think, you know, the Leafs do know they have that backup in Campbell. You know, he got the win the other day. You know, nothing outstanding, but certainly steady. He came off six games last season. You know, it's a small snapshot of what he can do, but certainly he can back up, and I think they have confidence in him as well. So I think it really provides a lot of flexibility for the Leafs as they move forward through the schedule, which is going to be extremely taxing. And as we know in this North Scotia division, I mean, it's going to be a battle. I mean, it's something we absolutely love. I know I find myself tuning in, not just because hockey is finally back on, but certainly because it's so exciting to be able to watch some of these players go head to head on a consistent basis. And it's going to get more heated as it goes on as well.
Cheryl Pander is with us as we get you set for Flames and Leafs at the top of the hour. So I look at Mitch Marner's start to the season, and I see 8 points in six games, 4 goals, 4 assists. Terrific. Like, you look at the numbers, they're great.
Yeah.
But I haven't been knocked out in terms of the sense of him, as we've seen so many times, taking over games. He took over the game against Ottawa last week where they won, and Matthews, him, and Thornton were tremendous and just an incredible performance from that line. But I guess it's easy to just say, well, he'll get better, and probably this is a glass half full situation because he's still got 8 points in six games and probably hasn't played anywhere near as well as he's capable of playing.
Well, I mean, he's the energy. You know, when I look at players like Marner, you know, just there's so much energy to his game. I mean, just always looks like he's having fun. And when you sort of see him in that mode, you know he's in his game. I mean, you can't really take away what he's done. He's also playing over 24 minutes a game. I mean, you're looking at a guy who is on every side of the puck. You know, he's on the PP, the PK. He's, you know, look at him 5-on-5. You know, he's been outstanding that way in terms of four even strength goals. So, I'm torn on that one with you. I might have to disagree a little bit. Here's a guy who can also be thrown around into multiple roles. So, do I think there's more ahead? Absolutely. But I certainly enjoy Thornton with him because I think it brings a lightness to his game as well, which I think he needs.
Yeah, no, I 100% agreed, Cheryl. Looking at some of the other forwards that really intrigued me, and someone who had a really good game the other day, Ilya Mikheyev, right? And I think there were some questions looking at Ilya, right, with the injury and would he regain the form we saw early last year, because, you know, the bubble play probably wasn't indicative of what, you know, he was capable of. And here you go, now he's playing really well. If he continues to play like this, how can we really justify not playing him in the top six?
Well, and that's the big question, right? I mean, is this checking line, you know, going to be with Kerfoot? You know, is this going to be something that Keefe is going to really look to? Because Mikheyev, I mean, he is really interchangeable in that top six, as we saw. And as you mentioned, I mean, I think he started at, you know, his first NHL game, and we kind of didn't really know who he was. And then all of a sudden he has a goal and assist, and we're watching this streak, you know, go across our screens. And he, much like Marner, to me, bring an energy to the game, which I think we saw the other night, you know, his skating ability, his ability to get on pucks quickly, create turnovers, and he can finish. So, you know, here's a guy, there's a lot of room there for him. And I think, you know, that's one of the great things about this Leaf team is their depth, right? And so there will be a lot of question as to where Mikheyev winds up by the end of this season. But certainly you're looking at a number of players that sort of can make that move. I mean, Robertson was one prior to his injury where we were looking at him and saying, is he a top six guy? Like, this kid is unbelievable with his shot and his ability to see the game. So, you know, a lot of question there. But again, Mikheyev certainly can be up in that top six.
Cheryl Pounder is with us, and I have to say I was very pleasantly surprised and impressed by the game that Pierre Engvall had the other night against Edmonton, because, you know, as we saw, he wasn't really part of the mix. He wasn't even on the taxi squad to start the season. Sheldon Keefe was very critical of how he was in training camp, and it just hasn't been a great last year. He's really struggled, but I just feel like he can really bring a lot to the table, you know, as a penalty killer, a big, strong skater. And I like that possible duo with Mikheyev. They might not have the softest hands in the world. They might not light the lamp all that often, but I feel like that could be a really effective presence with speed and size a little bit, especially in the neutral zone.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way that Keith came out on him, I mean, we knew he was in the doghouse, so we knew if he was coming into play, you know, he had to be effective. So, you know, here's a guy, he's got to be strong on the defensive side of the puck, but I agree with you with Mikheyev. I mean, these two guys, if they can, you know, generate that speed through that neutral zone, they can take away their opponent's space. You know, they are big bodies, they can get in there. So for me, you know, he's got to be defensively responsible. That's something that he will be looked upon to do, and keep it simple, you know, keep it simple, and progress towards, you know, having better shifts each and every time. Cause, you know, it's hard, you know, confidence is also a big thing with these guys. You know, it presents different things with the taxi squad and everything else that's going on around them, and knowing with all the injuries that they might get in, they've got to seize their opportunities. So Mikheyev, you're right. Engvall, I mean, just some great skating abilities, especially through that neutral zone, and the ability to enter the offensive zone with speed and take away it from it, their opponents as well, so they can close space really quickly, which is awesome.
So, you know, we've talked a lot, Cheryl, about the forward group, certainly as they deserve to be spoken about. But the defensive cores and the defensive pairing, I want to discuss with you a little bit as well. And, I mean, look, we all know what we're going to expect from Morgan Rielly and TJ Brodie. Of course, Brodie going to be playing in Calgary today for the first time since he signed in Toronto, which will be a lot of fun to see. But when it comes to that second pairing, right, that Muzzin-Hall pairing, I find that pairing so interesting because they're almost like we don't really talk about them because obviously Rielly and Brody are the top guys, and you kind of get to see with your eyes them a little bit more. But Hall specifically, I've been pretty quietly impressed from what I've seen at Justin Hall this year, considering that last year when the pairings were different with different guys back there as well, it was probably not the ideal pairing for him at times, considering it was, you know, injuries and new players shuffled things around a bit. But now that he has settled into things with Jake Muzzin so far, I think it's been a good, dependable, solid second line pairing.
Yeah, and I would agree with you 100%. And, you know, and I used to play, you know, as a defensive defenseman and you know, taking away the you know, shutdown, if you will. And so a lot of the times it kind of gets missed, right? So if Muzzin's playing physical, you don't really necessarily, you know, see them on the offensive side of the puck, which although Hall is certainly in his four assists has created some offense. But I'm with you. I've been pleasantly surprised with Hall in particular. I mean, even if you watched the Edmonton game the other day and McDavid, I mean, I thought he had a great one-on-one on him, you know, be able to skate with him, keep his stick on stick, although McDavid did get around with just his positioning of his stick, but it's Connor McDavid, for goodness sake. So, but, you know, one of those things is just having that ability to close the gap, these guys to finish their checks. And, you know, when they do that, it's amazing at how effective they are, keeping it simple, moving the puck quickly, and they've been pretty solid that way. And that's a pair that you need, right? That's something that every team needs. And I think that I'm with you. I think that Hall has certainly been someone for me that, you know, I've kind of pointed him out throughout the game, whether it's my husband or someone else I'm sitting by and say, you know, I really like him right now. So that's one that sort of had a check mark for me, and something that I think it just can continue to get better and grow as the season goes on.
I feel like this is the best Maple Leafs defensive group that I can remember, you know, certainly since like the Brian McCabe, Thomas Cabrelet days where they were making the playoffs, and Brian Leetch had one playoff run here. Like, it's been a really long time since Maple Leafs fans can say, you know, there are two legitimate pairings defensively that we feel comfortable throwing out there against, you know, somebody like Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl, and it's not a disaster. It may not always go swimmingly, but it's still pretty solid. And if that continues and they start to get a little bit more consistency between the pipes and a little bit more depth scoring, then I think we're going to start to see the team that a lot of people envisioned having a lot of success this season.
Yeah, and I mean, listen, guys, when people are saying, you know, we're playing too safe, I'll tell you two guys who don't mind it, right? The Muzzins and the Halls of the world, you know, when the score is, you know, you're only allowing two in or one in. I mean, yeah, it's not as, you know, exciting and chances left, right, and center. But for guys like that, you know, they're doing their job. So, you know, save for them isn't necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, we're watching that. And I agree with you. The depth is there. A little more strength in front of the net, you know, with Brody and Bogosian and you know, Muzzin Hall as well. So seeing some physicality with that depth certainly goes a long way in not being afraid to just move the puck north, right? Create some speed. We've got some great forwards on the Leafs, so it's pretty important to get them to the puck moving.
Cheryl, really appreciate the time today. Enjoyed it. Enjoy the game today, and let's do this again soon.
Thanks, guys. Have a great one.
Cheryl Pounder, really good stuff there. Two-time Olympic gold medalist for the Canadian national women's hockey team and co-host of the Her Mark podcast. Appreciate her taking a couple of minutes for us. And, yeah, we'll see what happens here today for the Leafs. But the Blue Line group has been encouraging. I can't understate that enough. It's been a pleasant surprise, even with Muzzin and Riley not playing tremendous and not being super consistent this year. I've still been impressed by Hall and Brody. And if those two, as we expect, start to play like they're advertised and like their contract and their place in the lineup dictates, I think this Blue Line group is going to be pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, look, we talked about it a lot, I guess, going into this shortened season, but how this is probably the best Blue Line that Freddie has played behind, I guess, in his entire tenure as a Toronto Maple Leaf. So basically dating back to 2016, thereabouts. And if that's the case, then yeah, I think a lot of really encouraging signs. I still think that, you know, I'd like to see, I said it to you many times, I'd like to see more of Mikko Lehtinen, but I mean, that's like it feels like right now that's a luxury more than anything else, given how everyone else is playing.
Yeah, I wonder if the season goes along, maybe we'll see a little less of Bogosian to keep him as fresh as possible for the playoffs, and then maybe you see more of Lehtinen. But yeah, I have no declaration one way or the other for Mikko Lehtinen, because he's like, what has he played, maybe 20 total minutes as a Maple Leaf? It's just, it's very difficult to really glean much from what we've seen so far, but maybe if he gets more ice time, he'll resemble the player that a lot of people were excited about coming over from the KHL. We're going to hear that George Armstrong bit before we sign off. He passed away earlier today at the age of 90, the former Maple Leafs captain, Stanley Cup champion, last one to hoist the cup back in 1967. But we haven't really had a chance because the game's been going on. Raptors in Indiana right now with about 3 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. They hold the 96-94 lead over the Pacers. Win or lose, you would hope that they'll be able to hang on here and pull this one out. Very impressive that without Siakam and Lowry, that they're in position to beat a legit Pacers team on the road. Tip my cap to them. It does sort of seem like things might be turning here a little bit for the Raptors.
Yeah, like you said, a couple minutes left in this game on Sportsnet, but I mean, given what we have seen out of the rotation today, and like you said, shorthanded obviously with no Lowry and no Siakam, I've really liked from what I've seen out of guys like Yuta Watanabe, what I've seen in limited action out of Stanley Johnson. And look, if you're going to just look at the box score, you're not going to be that impressed, because if you look at the box score right now, Watanabe has 3 points on 1 of 7 shooting, Stanley Johnson has 2 points on 1 of 6 shooting, but their hustle and energy on D and how they're helping to facilitate the ball, also crashing the boards. Watanabe has 6 rebounds, as does Stanley Johnson. I think like that kind of contribution when guys like Lowry and Siakam are out is what you need, right? Like you need that kind of grittiness for a team that lost a lot of that when they lost Gasol and Ibaka. So it was very pleasant to see. I really liked it. And then on the opposite side of things, OG Anunoby has been sensational today. He played close to 40 minutes, I think, so far. I think 37 minutes and counting here with a couple minutes left to go. And yeah, look, not a great free throw game, but I mean, 8 of 15 shooting for 24 points. He has been absolutely fantastic, and it makes me excited to see what we might get out of OG going forward.
And this is the thing with him, right? Usage-wise, if you dial up the usage, he, I think, is very much capable of having a game like this. But with Siakam and Lowry and Van Vliet in the lineup, he's just not going to see a tremendous usage rate. He's not going to have the ball in his hands, other than maybe attacking a closeout or certainly spotting up for a three. But if you maybe run the offense, like you can see, he and Van Vliet seem to be taking turns kind of initiating the offense right now. He's capable of doing this. We saw it a little bit at Indiana. We've seen it in spurts in his career where he can make plays for others. I'm just watching this game. Did you ever think we'd see a lineup closing crunch time as OG cans a three to put them up by 4 with a minute 50 to go, of OG Anunoby, Stanley Johnson, Bembry, Fred Van Vliet, and Norm Powell? What a lineup. Going up against Miles Turner and DeMontis Sabonis. Sabonis and holding their own for the most part. Very, very impressive.
Yeah, T.J. McConnell has been pretty good for the Pacers in this game as well. But yeah, Sabonis and certainly Aaron Holiday has played pretty well. And obviously Miles Turner, who can hit threes from basically anywhere. Yeah, the Pacers team is no joke. They're not a joke of a team. They're a very talented team. Even without Victor Oladipo, who has been shipped to Houston, and certainly Caris LeVert, who, you know, you hope is okay after they discovered the mass in his kidney, obviously. But even with those guys not in the rotation right now for Indiana, it's a very dangerous team, and given that the Raptors are severely shorthanded with two of their star players, like you said, yeah, what this team has been able to do with those guys. I mean, Bembry has played 19 minutes. Flynn has seen some time. Matt Thomas has seen some time. Terrence Davis has seen time. I gotta say, I'm impressed with what Nick Nurse and the coaching staff have been able to seemingly cobble together on the fly.
Yeah, I've been impressed with the way that they played the last, you know, week, 10 days, and we need to see a little bit more of it. A quick update, Tampa Bay scored on their opening drive in the NFC Championship game. Mike Evans caught two balls, Ooh. A long completion, and then a touchdown. So right now it's 7-0 for the Bucks. As
Brady looks so good, Josh.
He does look good. Yeah, as a longtime Patriots fan, you got to be, I don't know, conflicted. Probably not feeling amazing that he's just lighting it up in the NFC Championship game, and time is a flat circle, and he's never going anywhere, it seems like. But yeah, very, very impressive, and certainly not a great look for my Packers going to the Super Bowl start, but we'll see. Early days.
We'll see,
and
yeah.
Raptors right now are clinging to a lead. And actually, it's tied, 54 seconds to go in the fourth quarter. Good stuff, as always, show. We're back together next week at 12:30 to 5 on Sunday. Look forward to it, as always. I'm sure we'll have an exciting Super Bowl matchup to get into. And thanks to J.R. Manitad and Danielle Furtado, as always, for putting us on the air, putting together a great show. Appreciate their hard work. Would not be able to do it without them. And Leafs Nation pregame is coming up. We look forward to that with Gord Stellick and Nick Alberga. They'll get you set for Maple Leafs and Flames. Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, with puck drop set for just after 4 o'clock from the Saddle Dome. But as you heard, and as we talked about earlier, George Armstrong, the longtime captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs, passed away earlier today at the age of 90. We played the obit off the top of the show, and we felt it was very appropriate to end the show with a tribute to the life and times of George Armstrong. So let's hear it.
I had always been a Leaf fan when I was a youngster, and I was very confident of my playing ability at that time, and I thought perhaps that the Maple Leafs would come along and offer me a contract.
At center, over the line to Armstrong. He's going in a loop.
A lot of sweat goes into a hockey career in order for a person to win this. I suppose this is the aim of every young hockey player in Canada when he starts to play hockey, is to hope to play for a National Hockey League club and then to hope to get a Stanley Cup championship.
To be the Toronto Maple Leafs captain is both a privilege and a burden. George Armstrong embraced both and excelled at it. Conn Smythe once described him as the best captain, as a captain, the Leafs have ever had.
Well, this is the Stanley Cup. Last year when we won it, I was carried off the ice and it slipped out of one of my hands and almost fell. But there was about 15 players that were underneath it and they were ready to catch it.
George Armstrong was born outside of Sudbury, Ontario, to both Irish and Indigenous parents. As a boy, he dreamed of one day playing in the NHL, but had no idea what his impact would be on the team just a few hours south. He was a standout in junior hockey, catching the eye of the Maple Leafs, who placed him on their protected list and quickly moved him up to their junior team, the Marlboros.
I spent 2 years with Toronto Marlboro Juniors. At the conclusion of the final year with Marlboro Juniors, I played for the Marlboro Seniors. We went on to play against Calgary in the Allan Cup Finals, and we're lucky enough to beat them.
Armstrong had two successful seasons with the Leafs' AHL farm team, the Pittsburgh Hornets, before joining the Maple Leafs for good in 1952. In Maple Leafs tradition at the time, sweater numbers of great players were passed down to the next generation, as Armstrong inherited his boyhood idol Silap's number 10.
Is off now, Armstrong, should he score? Armstrong!
In 1957, he once again followed in App's footsteps and was named captain, an honor he would hold for a team record 12 seasons.
But I give a lot of credit to their captain, George Armstrong. He gives everything he's got out there, and I think that he's a great inspiration to his club. He's been a great captain of the Leafs, and I think every player on the club looks up to Armstrong because of the way he plays the game.
Armstrong led the Leafs to three straight championships in the early 60s, tying App's record for most cups as Leafs captain. But he will be best remembered most for his last cup against the fabled Canadiens in 1967.
It is now my very pleasant duty and responsibility to present the Stanley Cup to the Maple Leaf Hockey Club.
As he skated to center ice to collect Lord Stanley's cup, Armstrong broke from tradition and had his son Brian by his side.
We had the confidence in ourselves. We went out there and did the best we could, and we came through and we won it. And certainly it wasn't easy because that hockey team never stopped until the last bell went.
He hung up his skates in 1971, taking his leadership behind the bench to coach his old team, the Marlboros, and winning two Memorial Cups. In 1978, he left the Leafs organization for the first time to become a scout for the Quebec Nordiques. But he would return to Toronto 9 years later as assistant general manager, scout, and briefly head coach. For all his accomplishments, Hockey Hall of Fame inductee, and seven-time All-Star, no Maple Leaf played more games in the regular season or playoffs and is the only captain to raise the cup four times. George Armstrong will be remembered as a leader both on and off the ice. The Toronto Maple Leafs raised his number 10 to the rafters while being honored on Legends Row to be immortalized for Leaf fans forever.
The first star, George Armstrong, Toronto Maple Leafs.